It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Andy's here. Jason's here. Alex is here. And the new Apple Pencil is here. Is that it for 2023? We'll find out. We'll also talk about the new iPhone. Does it actually cost more to make? And why it's not doing as well in China and what Tim Cook's doing about it. It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 891, recorded Tuesday, October 17th, 2023. Room Tone Raters. This episode of Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Fastmail. Reclaim your privacy, boost productivity, and make email yours with Fastmail. Try it now, free for 30 days at fastmail.com/twit. And by Delete Me. Reclaim your privacy by removing personal data from online sources. Protect yourself and reduce the risk of fraud, spam, cybersecurity threats, and more by going to joindeleteme.com/twit and using the code TWIT for 20% off. And by our friends at IT Pro TV, now called ACI Learning. Keep your IT team's skills up with the speed of technology. Visit go.acilearning.com/twit. TWIT listeners can receive up to 65% off an IT Pro Enterprise solution plan after completing their form. Based on your team's size, you'll receive a properly quoted discount tailored to your needs. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest Apple news. And there's actually Apple News. Say hello to Jason Snell. So look at Jason and look at me.
Look at
what
us.
Do we have in common? Look at Jason and look at me.
So much.
We're both at mom's house.
Both at mom's house. Don't believe everything you see behind you.
Jason is deceiving us.
Yeah, I am.
I sent a green screen out here, but then I thought, this is kind of nice. This is like... mom's
it's a good background.
Stuff, right?
My background is not as interesting, so I'm going with my brand instead.
Yeah. I like your brand. He's also using continuity camera. So, oh, no, you're using camo.
Camo, yeah.
Camo today. I forgot what I mean. Oh, Insta360 has its own app, so I'm just using that. Yeah. Also with us, Mr. Andy Iannocco, just down the road a piece, a beautiful... Southern Rhode Island.
Or maybe I'm in the East Room of the White House. That's the great thing about having these screens behind me. I could be anywhere in the world and don't even have to tell anybody about it.
He's from the Roosevelt Library in beautiful downtown Washington, D.C.
Joe, start the game without me. I'll be there in a minute. I know.
Joe's such a stickler. You know, he really likes everybody to be there at the beginning.
He's a nut boy.
He's a whack.
But hey.
Hey.
He's not above knocking the controller out of your hands when you're playing couch co-op from Super Mario Brothers. Let me tell you.
Yeah.
I'm just tripping. Yeah, Joe, come on.
And then here's somebody who actually could be in the East Room of the White House. Alex Lindsay.
I was going to say, I think I saw a picture of Andy's kit. So I was, we were there and when I saw it behind the scenes, Andy was doing a little behind the scenes there. And I think it looked a lot like that. There it is. There's
OMG.
See him building into the East Room right there.
OMG. So anyway, so. You actually have footage. Wow. Officehours.global, and he's a little under the weather, got a cold, so that's why he sounds like Foghorn Leghorn. But it's okay. It's okay.
It's good to be here.
Hey, there's news. The new Apple Pencil is here. The new Apple Pencil is here.
Yeah. What, did you have this on your bingo card with maybe new Macs, maybe new iPads?
And everybody was so excited about, we've got inside information about a big, big release this week. We're pretty sure it's going to be new iPads. Let me give you a speculation about the new changes in the 7-inch iPad mini. Like, it's a pencil and not even a good pencil.
One news source did have that it was going to be just an Apple Pencil. But even then, they were like, yeah, it's going to be a third generation Apple Pencil with a magnetically changed tip and all that. And it's like, folks, this is Apple Pencil 2-0.5.
Oh, no.
Basically.
Is it from Crayola? What's the deal?
So it's funny you mentioned that because the Logitech makes a product called the Crayon and that sold to education. And it feels like Apple got the feedback that maybe that was a good product and they should make it themselves. So they did. They made this thing that is USB-C.
Well, that's an improvement. That's good.
Sure.
We should make USB-C all the things. It's not a magnetic tip?
No, it's basically a decontented Apple Pencil too. So they it doesn't charge wirelessly. You have to plug in a USB-C cable to it.
See, but that's
that
does
mean
nice
that it will work with every USB. I think basically every shipping iPad will work with it, including that 10th generation they announced with that weird dongle, the Lightning to USB-C dongle thing that they had to make in order to work with the 10th generation base model iPad.
This is deceptive because they're showing it. This is a picture of this press release.
So
docked to a screen, but it's not charging.
It attaches magnetically. Yeah. And in fact, there are magnets in that 10th generation iPad, but what they don't do is charge it. You charge it by plugging it in via the USB-C cable. But so on one level, it's better than what was there before. On another level, I mean, I got a bunch of questions. One is, why now? This is the product that should have shipped with that 10th generation iPad a year ago. So why now? That's sort of strange. And then, you know, another question to have is, you know, why a decontented pencil? Because it's actually less functional than the first generation pencil in the sense that it doesn't do any pressure sensitivity. That's why I mentioned the Logitech Crayon. Logitech made this product called the Crayon. You had to plug it in separately to charge it, and it didn't have pressure sensitivity, but it was cheap. And I think it was targeted at education. And it sounds like Apple got a lot of feedback. Look, the low end of the iPad market is so much driven by what Apple's education partners want. That's why the 9th generation iPad still exists, because the 10th generation one is too expensive for them. And this feels very much like the same kind of thing where they were saying, we need a cheaper pencil. And rather than having Logitech continue to sell that that crayon, they're like, no, we can make you a cheaper pencil. And it solves the problem of Lightning versus USB-C. But make no mistake, this is not like next gen pencil. It's less functional than not just the second gen, but even the first gen.
Yeah, it's also missing the side tab for extra functionality. As Jason said, one of the neat wireless charging was one of the handiest parts about the real pencil. The one that didn't do wireless charging, at least as much as people made fun of it, you undo the cap and hey, look, it's actually got a male connector, so it can actually plug directly into the charge port. This has a female USB-C, so you're going to have a cable in order to charge it. And it's not even that much less expensive. I think the Logitech Crayon was $49 or a little bit less than that. This is $79, and so it's $50 less than what I think we can legitimately call the real pencil. But it's not so much less that it's like, oh, thank God, the Apple Pencil is now reachable to a whole class of people who couldn't afford it before. It's more like, and given that it's not that much better than a stylus, I mean, you do like a dumb stylus. I mean, you do have tilt sensitivity. So, and there are a lot of apps that will kind of leverage that to try to give you with acceleration, not pressure sensitivity, but at least variations in thickness, more a lively line. But all the fun things that make you want to have a pencil with an Apple logo on it are missing from this. So it's odd.
And I think that but proportionality, I think, matters to some degree, which is that if you're aiming at the 9th generation iPad, having something $129 is a third of the cost of the iPad. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there's a proportionality of lowering that. And I think the problem with the Logitech is, for students, it looks a little goofy. You know, like it's just a goofy looking.
It looks like a
stylus.
Kid's pencil. It's embarrassing. So,
I think it looks like a carpenter's pencil or something. Yeah. Right?
Well, it does. It's flat.
It has some issues. Yeah. It's got a power on off feature that you have to do, which I think that this one, if you magnetically draw, it's got some smart power consumption things, so it turns itself off basically, and that's not what happens with the Logitech one. I think you have to turn it off, so you can. It's really easy to drain the battery. But yeah, this is, I think, the only way to view this. This is one of those weird things where you kind of have to view it in the market in which it's intended. Although I would say, it almost feels like we're headed into Apple Pencil and Apple Pencil Pro territory here.
Yeah.
A little bit, where like the next pencil will be super cutting edge, and then they'll also have this one that's like the cheap one if you don't care. Because a lot of people don't care about pressure sensitivity. Honestly, I use the Apple Pencil to edit podcasts. I don't need pressure sensitivity at all. Yeah. I could probably use this. But you do forego, I have an iPad Pro, you forego that really easy pairing and charging stuff if you go this route. But
yeah, that seems they do. I mean, in the features list, they do put in terms of functional functions. The number one is pixel perfect precision, which is not just alliterative, but that's probably the one thing that is a deal breaker for pretty much everybody who wants a device like this. The ability to that the dots and the lines go exactly where I expected them to be, and that it keeps up with my writing. That's probably the table stakes that this is designed to serve. And then anything beyond that is just gravy.
Yeah, because, you know, a lot of the people who, you know, one of the use cases is note taking and things like that, or even my podcast editing or whatever. And packing a bunch of really detailed features for artists in a product that also has this other use case, I can see the argument that maybe in the long run, this ends up being updated at some point with that magnetic charging. But basically what they're saying is, look, we know a lot of you don't need this, so we're going to make a cheaper version of it too. Yeah. It's just weird because now we've got a first gen and a second gen, and now here's a new pencil, but it's really not even, it's kind of a step behind the second, if not a step behind the first. So it's just, they're broadening their product. The iPad line is so confusing right now. They haven't, keep in mind, they haven't announced any iPads this year at all. And the optimist in me wants to say, maybe they're like getting it together for next year where it'll actually make a little more sense. But some of the things, I wrote a piece about this this morning at Six Colors. Some things aren't going to change because, like, Tim Cook's Apple is a company that will keep old products around to hit price points. And it's clear that that ninth generation iPad, which was supplanted by the 10th generation iPad a year ago, is still around because the school buyers said, we're not paying an extra $100 for that other iPad. We want this one that's cheaper. Yeah. And so here we are, where you end up with some weird products in the product lineup because that's Apple sometimes is just trying to meet some markets. And if you're not in that market, you might say this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. It's also kind of weird to me that they, if you put these two side by side, granted, I'm only going from the product page, but they seem to be, they look identical. They seem to be the exact same size, or at least on the screen, if they're depicted at the same angle, they are the same pixel height on the web page side by side.
The Apple Pencil 2 and this one. Yeah.
Yeah, I would have been surprised if they didn't decide to make this a little bit shorter, A, just to make it really distinctive that, hey, I'm picking up something that is the $129 one, not the lesser $80 one, but also to make it maybe a little bit more totable. It's not that the original Apple Pencil is hard to carry around, but it's just long enough to sort of foil your attempt to just throw it into a bag or throw it into like a pencil pouch that's attached to whatever it is that you got. Particularly if you're thinking about this as an accessory for the iPad mini, you would think that a smaller version of this would also appeal for that kind of thing. But just, again, just to make sure that make these things as distinctive as possible, that's an interesting move as far as I'm concerned.
You know, it's funny that the name is the USB-C pencil, as if that's the feature. I mean, to the casual consumer, when you look at that product chart, it just, I mean, yeah, it has hover, but it doesn't have pressure. It's kind of a weird mix of features and non-features. But when you look at that chart, look at the title, it's the USB-C pencil.
Yeah.
And I feel like consumers are going to go in, and that's the distinction.
If it had anything to do with the EU or anything else, I'm just saying, here's a, you know, it's an electronic device that has USB-C, like it, where there was something there.
Maybe it's the EU. Maybe it's schools that said, look, if you're going to sell us stuff, it's all got to charge with the same connector because we got a cart.
The reason this is happening is because they're moving all their products to USB-C, and that iPad 10th gen moved to USB-C.
Right.
And they didn't have a pencil that worked with it, right?
Right.
Because they didn't have, it doesn't have magnetic attachment with charging, right?
So it's really that iPad 10,
the iPad 10, they sold
iPad.
They said you had to use the first Apple Pencil, which was like, wait a second, that's still around? With a weird dongle that was a Lightning to USB-C
dongle.
So you plug it into Lightning and then plug it in, and it was all janky and wiggly and stuff. And like, this product is made for that, but it also does serve the market of sort of like, it works with all these other iPads. So it's like, if you want a cheaper one, you can do it. But like,
what are the three price points?
Because the first generation pencil can't stick around. It's just got a Lightning nub on the back. And,
right. I feel like they're phasing that one out. But what are the three price points?
This is the new one's $129. The Apple Pencil Pro, if we want to call it that, is $129. The new Apple Pencil USB-C is $79. The Apple Pencil first generation is $99.
Okay. So it sounds
cheaper.
That's interesting. So it's the cheapest of the three.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder. I mean, honestly, they've got to be phasing out the original Apple Pencil, right?
Yeah, the problem is the reason it's not gone yet is because they still sell the ninth generation iPad, which has Lightning, which means it only works with the first generation. This is what I was writing about this morning specifically. Is like, this is the price you pay for having the strategy where you hold you make some cheaper products by holding old products around a little too long. Is you end up, when you're in a technology transition like we are with Lightning and USB. You end up with this Lightning iPad that the schools still want, and you're like, oh, and then they want pencils for it. And if you're Apple, you're like, oh, God, I don't want to make a pencil for it.
Right.
Although that said, I think this pencil works with it, but you have to charge it via USB-C. But I think they work. You can correct me if I'm wrong.
I think they work on all of them. I think it's just
on all of them. So this does get you out of the original pencil eventually, which is good because that product is. What, 10 years old now?
Yeah.
It's like, it's been around. It's time to go.
It must be driving the engineers at Apple crazy, because it's just aesthetically, it must be making them
nuts. This thing took a year to make. I'm sure there was like a team that worked on this for a year, and it just got, you got to feel like you're kind of on a, like, okay, well
all right. No, because I think what happened is, you know, whoever the engine, I can't keep track of Apple VPs anymore, but whoever is responsible for this came to them and say, look, guys, you're going to be making the new Apple Pencil. It's going to be the base model. Don't tell anybody that. But we can't get rid of that other one. But this is the new base model Apple Pencil. And that's what you're going to be making. You got to hit a low price point.
Don't know why this didn't happen last year. Like, what made, because last year they could have come out and said, okay, old pencil's gone, new pencil's here, works with USB-C, still works with the old ninth gen. If you want to, you just have to, you know, get a cable or whatever. Like, it would have been so much cleaner. And instead, it's like a whole year later. So something happened.
Well, it could have been feedback at that point where they come out with it, and people go, "Hey, what the what?" You know, we're missing this thing, and they're like, "Okay." And then it takes a year. Like it's not like when you talk about mass production of products with electronics, anything new, from them getting feedback to them releasing a product is a year.
It could be the case. However, this is going to sound weird, but like, I give Apple enough credit and the people there to be smart enough that I don't think that's what happened, because I think it was apparently clear the moment that product came out last year, we were all like, what? You've got a weird adapter for the original pencil for a brand new iPad? Why are you doing this? And this product is the answer to like, oh, well, no, we're doing this other thing. And yet it didn't exist. Maybe there was a fight and it got deprioritized, and then they heard the feedback from customers and they're like, all right, we do have to do it. But I am positive that the people involved in the iPad going into that product announcement last year knew that this was a bad idea and that they needed to do something else. But for whatever reason, my guess is they just couldn't, you know, it was deprioritized and there was other stuff that was more important. So it just got left behind.
I'm clear that they saw that it was a problem. I just think that they didn't know how deep the water was until they got feedback.
Just wait and see. Like, right.
Okay. Yep. Now we're going to have to do something about But from the time they make that decision to the time it comes out is a year, like, you know, for a piece of hardware.
Well, anyway, there's a new Apple Pencil.
I think we got as much meat out of that as we were going to get.
We talked for
20 minutes about
it. So people should know about the Logitech Crayon, because that is a good product.
And how much is that?
It might fill your needs. $59?
So it's even less. Like,
it's $49, okay. isn't it?
It's $49. Yeah, it's cheap. Yeah. It's cheap. It's
and
good.
It doesn't do as much.
It doesn't do as much, but it may serve everything. You well, and you might even like the ergonomics a little bit better because it is a little bit fatter.
And to Alex's point, Apple knows what people use these for and what features they use and don't use.
And also, I only discovered this morning because somebody on my Mastodon feed pointed out this new Apple Pencil for $79, very similar in all specifications to knockoff Apple Pencil compatible things you can get on eBay and Amazon for like $20 or $30. It's literally like, this is what the knockoff would look like, which is, well, we can't do pressure sensitivity, but we can stick a USB port on it. And like, so those are out there too. I've never even tried one of them, but apparently, you know, they've been around for a while. The Apple version will run you $79.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was completely wrong. The Crayon is $69.
Oh, now that's interesting, because that's the education price.
And the Crayon works with, I believe, every iPad that supports Apple Pencil, every single one.
This would too, right?
I'm not sure if it does. Maybe.
I think the specs say all iPads with USB-C, but I don't know if that means just for charging or whether it was.
Oh, it must work with every iPad.
You have to pair it.
It may not do, yeah.
So
oh, that's right. You have to pair via the cable, right?
Right, which you don't have to do with the
that's so ugly.
The crayon. So there's,
yeah.
There's, you know, there's alternatives, I guess is what I'm saying, if you're thinking about buying a thing for your iPad.
Jason's piece is at sixcolors.com, the price of Apple's old products strategy. And I think it's actually a perfect explanation of what's going on. And I think this is the exact right way to respond to what Apple just did.
Yeah. And it is a mess.
Explain it.
But
it's a mess.
But you got to understand. It's the same reason why the 13-inch MacBook Pro exists, right? It's like, well, we need to.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense except if you're in a very particular market where they know that people want to buy MacBook Pros and don't want to buy a $2,000 MacBook Pro. So you say, all right, we'll call this one a MacBook Pro, right. Even though it's nothing like the real MacBook Pros.
It explains
the same reason why it's complicated to buy an iPhone, because there's a 15 and a 14 and a 13 that's still for sale, right? Like,
I still feel like we keep on going back into the Apple 90s, you know, the dark time when we had when I couldn't figure out when I as a person who uses right. Apple just could not figure out what to buy.
That's why Steve came in with that
the
famous
one with the
quadrant
TV tuner or the one with the thing
and right. LC Centris
29 23B
of everything
at Sears. Now I think the one I'd say for those of us who are like always buying latest and greatest products, it's absolutely confusing to look at the website and see what they're doing. Their motivation is to expand the number of people who can buy Apple products because, you know, the longer you make a product, the cheaper it is to make it. So your margins go up, and that allows you after a year to lower the price and still make profit. And Apple has used that to expand their audience and their customer base because those products, they're able to reach down to lower price points. And I think I was thinking about this the other week. I don't know if Apple has ever really been successful at making like a cheap product. It feels like they're more successful in making cutting-edge product and letting it kind of age down the price list instead. Right. But as a result, I'm sure there is a huge portion of Apple's audience that's here now that wasn't here 5 years ago because they weren't going to buy that full price whatever Apple product. And instead, they were able to save up and buy the, you know, the one-year-old product that went down $100 or two.
I think it makes a huge impact as a parent. I think it makes a huge impact on, kids having, why so many kids have iPhones is because it was more affordable. If you only stayed with the top of the line iPhones, it would be a different market, but that's why there's 87% of kids, in under 18 are using iPhones is because there were affordable versions to use.
Yeah.
And so it made a big difference.
Yep.
Leaves us in the position of guessing. Apple has the information, engineering information, consumer information, use information that we don't. And so we have to guess at why they did a product like that. But I think you're reading the tea leaves pretty accurately. Now, would you please explain the Mac Studio display to me? Because
I just bought another one. So I
did you? explained it. Jason,
I did.
Buy
well,
more.
So the truth is Apple made this sort of Retina decision about what a Retina screen was, and it's 5K at 27 inches, and almost nobody else in the computer industry cares.
Right.
I mean, basically nobody else cares.
Yeah.
And so the Studio display exists because it's nice, it does the job, and there is very little competition. I reviewed that Samsung competition where they ended up pricing it the same as the Studio display. It does have an adjustable stand, which the base model Studio display doesn't. It's got some smart TV features. It also puts a big blue box up every time you turn it on or you shut down your computer because it's no signal. I'm going to shut down
that.
In a minute.
That's
it's
a feature
super,
on Samsung TVs too.
It's
I
basically
hate it.
A TV that is doubling, but like it's that and the LG Ultrafine. Like there are basically none. And so the Studio display exists to give people a nice option for a lot of money that has all the features a Mac user expects. Now, if you want to get a 4K at 27, right. You can do that. It's just not going to be the same resolution as like your laptop because Apple's decided Retina is higher resolution than that.
And that makes a difference to you, obviously, or you wouldn't have bought another one.
I got so frustrated trying to find alternatives, and I finally looked at the refurb store one day in a moment of weakness and said, we can ship this to you on your birthday for $200 off or whatever. And I was like, fine, do it. Fine.
Happy birthday to me.
It's a birthday present. Fine. Because I was just tired of looking, and I didn't want to invest even $500 in a 27-inch 4K display where I was going to switch between that and my 5K display and be like, oh boy, this one. Like, I'm a little spoiled by it, and I decided I wasn't going to go down that route, and it's Apple's fault. I blame Apple. That's what I'm saying. It's not my fault. And I don't have a problem. It's Apple.
Totally. And I have to admit that for me, I just get lots of 1080p displays. I've got, you know, my Mac, my studio runs four of them, and then I've got a bunch of other displays over here, so I just keep on buying cheap 1080p Dells, and I just keep adding those to it. For me, it also has to do with routing. So I have a 8x8 it's a 4K router, but I don't, you know, I don't route it. And then I have a switcher that it goes into. So it's really what drives me to 1080p is I have the ATEM Extreme, you know, is there, and everything has to run into it. And because everything has to run into it, it all has to be 1080p. And then that just drove, well, I just need all 1080p screens. so it's a kind of a backwards solution, but that's what's kept me from buying the Apple one, is that when I get used to lots of monitors, I get used to, oh, I'm just going to move that over here. I'm going to put this out of the way. And I've gotten used to having lots of monitors. I usually have eight or nine.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's very easy for me to like segregate parts of my workflow to actual tactile frames that this belongs in. Also, there are times when the Raspberry Pi 5 came in, like I can't take, if I had an $800 like larger screen, I couldn't just say, can I just snap $220 of this screen off so I can put it next to this and just connect it to the Raspberry Pi 5? So, because there are times where, like, just for like a couple of weeks, there's a project where I need a screen like in the living room to attach to this thing right here, right now. And so it's nice to take one of the three screens off of my desktop and put it someplace else temporarily.
Well, and mine are all on arms. So I have all these, they're all just attached to my desk. So I kind of move them around and twist them. And if I'm standing up and working on something, I need to see what's going on. I can spin it. And so I'm just kind of used to them all kind of floating around. So
I do need to ask you, though, actually, and Jason, too, what is your position on portrait mode displays? Like I'm taking on the arm and twisting it so that it's portrait mode instead of landscape mode.
The last time I did that was the late 80s. Now I will tell you that I
was it with this radius, one of those radius displays.
It was a different time.
The last time I did it, I was using PageMaker, you know, and we would.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was, and you'd spin it up so that, you radius? Work on the whole page.
Who made those? Was it Radius?
I think it was Radius.
Yeah, it was Radius.
But I know editors who love to put their, like, so they'll be like Final Cut editors and they'll have it vertical and they'll put a whole bunch of their dialogue boxes and, you know, are their menu. Yeah.
I see that a lot in edit suites with people have a vertical display as well as, you know, they have to have a TV.
Vertical next to a landscape display. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've tried it. You know, the Samsung display did it. I tried it with the studio display, and it's very, you know, because it's just that top is so high up there that I can't see anything on it. It's ridiculous. However, when I'm writing on my iPad, I have a little stand for that, and I'll write like
write sideways,
a different desk or whatever, and I will rotate and have it be vertical on the iPad because it's not too big, and it allows me to have, I don't need that extra width, right?
It's like a page.
You want your paragraphs to be
kind
of narrow width.
It's like an 8.5 by 11 page, yeah.
So instead, I can see more of my article as I'm writing, and that's great. But like today's big monitors, I don't like them vertical because, you know, it's either you're looking down at your legs or you're looking up at the ceiling in order to see the edges.
It's because of those monitors that people still think Mac people are a little quirky and weird, I think. I'm convinced.
Could be.
We are the crazy ones.
Yes.
Multi-display lifestyle. Multi-display lifestyle in general has been a trait of Mac users from the beginning, because remember, Windows didn't ever really support it very well for a long, long time.
It was terrible for a long time.
And the Mac always did. And so, yeah, the Mac user, back in the 90s especially, you'd end up with, you're like, what's a Mac user like? And it's like, well, they're an artist and they probably work in the design department. And they definitely have like three monitors.
All rotated 90 degrees from one another.
and I think for me, it's because they all deliver to a switcher, then I, you know, all of them have to be available. You're
face it, Alex, you're not like anyone else.
No, you're Jerry Todd.
It's not. I don't know. In obviously, my problem is that in office hours, everybody on the show is like that.
Very strange subset of friends.
My tribe.
Your tribe.
But we all have multiple. Like anytime someone shows behind the scenes, I'm not even in the top 50%.
Actually, you know what I like? And I got it for my son. He saw it and he said, I have to have this. I have a 55-inch OLED. It's not TV. It's a was expensive display. That's four 1080p displays, but there's no bezel, so you can basically have just windows instead of displays all arranged weirdly. Yeah. And I actually prefer that. And it's got that same problem though you talked about, Jason, which is the top of
far away
is kind of a hello.
And well, I think go ahead, Andy.
No, it's because I don't know why I did this after a lifetime of having like one, two, three displays. But 2 years ago, I switched to one screen on top of the other. So one is down low and almost like desk height. The other one is right on top of it with like just a little gap in between the two. And so for things that, for some reason, my workflow changed so that it's like for stuff where I'm just writing, I want my eye level like low so I don't get neck strain. But then occasionally I need to glance up to check on something, but then glance back down again. Yeah. And it took me a while to realize that, oh, that's why like my neck is sore because I'm doing this instead of this. But like when you have, every now and then I get in like to test out like a super big like display. And every time I try one of these things, I just keep coming back. When it comes time to send it back, it's not like I get tempted to buy one of these things, because for some reason that black tiny little border of a 1440 display contains my focus and contains like my attention in a way that having this big wide cornfield in front of me where I can just put a window wherever I want it just doesn't do it. And that's why one of the things I'm curious about with the Apple Vision Pro is that like if I can truly put a display wherever I want it in my field of view, which of those two different philosophies is going to win out. The idea that I have lots of tiny little displays in my range of attention, or big displays that kind of occupy all my focus at once.
I, for this setup here at my mom's, I actually bought this crazy stand, which I will recommend. It's really sturdy, and it brought my laptop up to eye line because I didn't want to be looking down and then looking up. So I'm looking straight ahead. And then the first thing I said before the show was, gosh, I need another monitor. I'm thinking, I need several monitors.
That's what I use my iPad for. When I'm on the road.
Well, I have a 14-inch USB-C monitor that I could plug in.
Right.
It's a USB monitor. It's not high quality, but it'd be perfect for instance, I'm going to do an ad now, and it'd be nice to have the copy there. Yeah. Instead, I have to switch windows around and stuff like that.
I have to say that I get more excited about what happens when I add a new like monitor arm to my setup than buying a new screen, because it's truly like what Alex said. Like when you have these things on arms and you can move them exactly where you want them to go, and suddenly the iPad isn't on this little like awkward little like cheap $20 table stand you got on Amazon, but it's on its own pivoting arm, so now it can be an extension of something else. It's like, granted, I'm losing a lot of time in getting the positioning of these things exactly perfectly.
Well, see, that's what I wonder. Right, but is that better than a giant screen, like a 55-inch screen? The screen fills my view. Yeah.
But the problem.
So I could have anything wherever I want it. It's all the same computer, though.
But the problem is that, like, on the edges of that screen, unless you're buying a curved screen, it's not facing you. You're basically seeing it at an oblique angle.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't really register to me as it always registers to me as peripheral vision, as opposed to something I can really actually look at when I'm looking directly at it.
Well, and for me, it's not one computer. So I have a bunch of computers that here. Too. So there, so there's different computers.
So no, for me, having it on one computer is what I want, because I don't want to have multiple, you know, I want to have, and I can move the windows around. So I guess it's just different strokes.
Yeah.
We got another huge story just out. Hannah Waddington's Christmas special coming up. We'll talk about that for all you Ted Lasso fans. But first, a word from our sponsor. She is, isn't she? So I mean, the Joey Heatherton or Lola Falana. You're conflating. No, I understand. Intentionally.
I'm quoting the SCTV version of Joey Heatherton as portrayed by the immaculate Catherine O'Hara.
There's always been a Joey Heatherton, Lola Falana, Angie Dickinson, Charo. There's always been that. So I guess we need one. Hannah Waddington, ladies and gentlemen.
There you go.
Our show today brought to you by Fast Mail. Make email work for you with Fast Mail. I have been for more than a decade now. I was, like many of you, using the free Gmail, or maybe you're using the free Outlook.com Microsoft email, or you know, some of you are still on AOL.com. Please, now is the time to change. Free email means you're the product, not the customer, right? You're not giving them money. The advertisers are. So when it's free, it means you're going to get advertising. It means you're going to get poor support because that's expensive. That's why I pay for Fastmail. And by the way, it's not expensive, as little as $3 a month, but you get real support from real people who can really help you, a service that's better, and there's no spam from the service, no ads on your screen, just great email. And they are doing it right. In fact, Fastmail is, in the email community, I think, a leader. They often introduce new technologies. They use the open source Cyrus IMAP server, and they contribute back to that. I think pretty much considered one of the leading, if not the leading, company working on email today. You will love Fastmail. You really will. I can go on and on about its features. The best spam filtering I've ever used, and that's saying a lot. Gmail used to be very good, but this is even better. You can write your own scripts in the Civ language if you want. The thing about Fastmail, it's easy to use for beginners. It's very straightforward, very simple. But if you want to get deep into the weeds on email, you can. And I like that. My email is authenticated with SPF and DKIM, and that happens automatically. I can bring as many domains as I want to Fastmail. And each domain can have an infinite number of emails associated with it, which means every time I sign up for something, it's got a unique email. If you use Bitwarden or 1Password, Bitwarden our sponsor, or 1Password, another great password manager, you'll love the fact that you can generate emails for each login. So you have a unique password, but also a unique email. They all go back, though, to your Fastmail inbox. Fastmail supports, I think, the five big companies that offer that kind of, I don't know what you call it, custom email addresses for security. They also have a great... Now, some of you I know like to use your own email client, whether it's Apple Mail on the desktop or the iPhone, or maybe Thunderbird, or you know, there are lots of great email clients. They will all work because Fastmail's real IMAP, unlike Gmail, which is kind of pseudo IMAP. Fastmail's real IMAP, so it works with all email clients. But if you like that web-based email that you get with the other guys, Yahoo and Gmail and all the rest, Fastmail has a fantastic web client. In fact, I've actually stopped using the desktop client on my computers and just use the web client because it's so good. It has quick settings. You can easily choose a new theme, switch between light and dark mode, change your text size without leaving the screen you're looking at. I also use Fastmail's calendars and contacts and notes, all using standard CalDAV, WebDAV, CardDAV, so you can use it with Apple's contacts and sync up. I've literally replaced Google in terms of contacts, address, and email with Fastmail. It's a really great solution. You can also use Fastmail's clients on iOS and Android. I do. They're great. They're the best. I can go on and on. Fastmail is easily the leader in email and email privacy because Fastmail believes that you're a customer, someone that you care for, not a product to be exploited. No advertisers. You're the center of what Fastmail does. Fastmail, your data stays yours with better productivity features, as little as $3 a month, better spam filters, absolutely no ads. You can get your old email, bring it into your new Fastmail inbox, or continue to go out and fetch the old email if you want to keep that address alive. And of course, you can keep all your existing software. Fastmail, moving email forward with new internet standards, open source innovations that power many other email services. Don't get left behind by number two, by substandard email providers. Use the best. And I can say this with confidence because I've been using nothing but Fastmail for more than a decade now. Reclaim your privacy. Boost productivity with Fastmail. Free for 30 days, fastmail.com/twit. Please use that address so you get the 30-day trial, but also so they know you saw it here. fastmail.com/twit for people who care about their privacy. Like you and me. What is this with iPhone 15 screen burn-in? It got me all worried now. You got me all nervous. Is this a problem, Jason, or is it just the usual Redditor saying, hey, you know what else?
I don't know. I got a big shrug on this one. I don't know what's going on with this.
I haven't seen any.
This attempt at a gate.
Yeah. It's a gate.
Apple Insider did a report on this a couple weeks ago. For basically, it's kind on one level, it's typical of what happens the first few weeks after there's a brand new iPhone. That it's not that there are people complaining. It's just that every person who experiences a problem. That gets a lot of attention almost immediately, and people start to get on guard because once you have 10 people saying that, hey, I've experienced a screen burn-in issue, then it starts to look like a calamity, even though at this point it's just 10 people on Reddit and Twitter and whatever. Apple Insider actually looked into it and said that they did, from their own metrics, they haven't seen a larger incidence of this as far of the usual metrics that they monitor online than they have with the iPhone 14. However, apparently, I just saw today that Apple a report that 17.1 has some sort of a fix for screen burn issues. As usual, it's oftentimes it's not when you see problems like this, it's not because there's a hardware problem, but because everything about the hardware, primarily the battery and the screen, they're tuned for certain reasons, and sometimes Apple will adjust that tuning when it turns out that okay, we're used to getting like 50 complaints about this, we got 80 complaints about this, so therefore we're going to actually tune this a little bit differently. So it doesn't seem to be an epidemic, but it's something that Apple at least said, hey, here's something that we can fix in order to so that the people who are having these problems will not see these problems.
Well, then there's also thumbs up gate. Thanks to Matt Howie of XOXO, who I love. Matt's a great guy. He says a friend of his was in an online therapy session. His therapist asked him, how's the trauma going? And his friend went, 2 thumbs up. And fireworks went off because he was using continuity camera. I guess
it seems to be happening to a lot of people. It's not just continuity camera. It is if you're using in the new OS, if you're using the web camera, any web camera,
it's
any
all
input.
Video.
All videos.
Can
I was
you do
using
it?
My iPhone. This is every webcam. Anything that's going through the pipeline is now available to Apple to put those effects in. And if you don't turn them off, we're seeing it in meetings all the time
because
people are just going, hey, and they're doing whatever.
Oh, there goes Andy. Quick, get Andy.
So that stuff is happening, and it's been a little bit, you know, usually
that's the trauma, Andy. Oh, now he's all frozen.
Apple, now it's frozen in my video. Hey.
Nice. Thank you. Yeah.
I mean, oftentimes Apple.
I don't think Camo Studio liked that one tiny bit.
Oh, dear. What and Jason, your confetti is coming from
from inside the house. Yeah, it turns out it's a per app setting, and you can turn it off, but it's on by default. And I understand why, because Apple does that thing where they're like, look, if we don't make it on by default, nobody will ever discover it. And I get that, but this is the case, and it's not just Matt Howie. Mike Hurley told me this week that he was actually having a session with his therapist, and suddenly balloons appeared everywhere. And it's like,
is why I go in person to my
therapist. You gotta go in person. Well, I don't know. Somebody could be back there with balloons.
I don't want balloons. If I want balloons, I'll bring them.
You know something? I mean, Dad's been diagnosed with cancer and doesn't look good. But you know what? I feel that we're going to come together as a family. And
So where do I turn that on, or in this case, off?
So
Jason,
if you're using Sonoma, when you have a video camera running, there's a green box in the menu bar
that shows a picture
of the camera. And if you click on that, you'll get
reactions.
Settings. And one of them is reactions, and you can turn it off. Also, if you'd like to trigger a reaction without actually making the gesture, you can turn it on and then click the little disclosure triangle, and you can actually click to make them go there. So you go there. Thanks, Leo. And that's also where you can control center stage or zoom in and out and pan around on some Apple cameras.
Our technical director. Just falling asleep. There we go. What? Huh? Leo's doing hearts? Oh, quick.
Yep.
That's cool. And I So I'm just clicking.
All that's in there.
But so these are all normally hand gestures, yes?
Yes. Yeah, it's like thumbs ups or thumbs downs or.
Oh, Cleveland, are you ready to rock and roll? This is fun.
I
should stop clicking all of these, but I'm not going.
Right, but you can turn them off. But I think it's an interesting question, right? Like if you're at Apple, like you don't want to not show people the new feature, But this is the downside is that it's going to be an inappropriate context and people are not going to necessarily know. You also don't want to do something like you could detect when they do a gesture and not do it, but then pop up a thing saying, hey, did you know there are new gestures?
Would you like?
I think they do the first time you activate, they do a thing that says, look, there are new effects, but most people just click through that.
Yeah.
And the last thing you want, if you interrupt somebody in the middle of a video conference in order to say, oh, hey, we've got this thing, they're just going to click through it because they don't want to be interrupted. So there's no good, I mean, this is the challenge of writing computer things, right? Is like people don't use anything but the defaults, but sometimes the new defaults confuse them and they don't know how to turn it off. And like, when is the right time? Because people are busy and they're doing other stuff. It's a hard problem. So I think these are fun features, but I also totally get that they seem inappropriate in certain circumstances. And it might be, the best I could come up with is maybe that Apple should have a more powerful API to let individual apps or websites that are using these features have some like more visible, like, can we turn this off, please? kind of stuff.
I think we've got the solution. Matunos, responding to Matt Howie, said, if you flip off the camera, it should turn it off.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
There won't be any misunderstandings then.
Yeah. Why? I gotta.
Yeah. I haven't seen anybody, happily surprised.
Right.
You know, now once people know that it's there, they have
then
fun
they
with
do
it.
Yeah.
But I will say that the first time it happens, almost every time it's been in a meeting and people are like, what the what? You know, and it's embarrassing and they're a little like, they don't. And what's interesting is that to Jason's point, they probably click through something, but most of the time they don't know why it did it. Like they don't understand, like I didn't turn anything on, I didn't do anything, and now it's doing this crazy thing, and they don't know how to turn it off. They don't know where it came from.
They don't know where it came from is the key. I think that's really the key.
Yeah.
They don't even know. Like they're like, I don't know why that happened. And there was I had a client that was like, is this Zoom? Zoom keeps doing
Who's
this?
Doing
like,
it?
Not Zoom.
Right.
Like, you know.
And also it's the kind of feature where if it's screwing up for you, it's screwing up in real time in public. It's not like the times where, hey, how come I type something and now there's a squiggly line that wasn't there before? Huh, I think I'll go investigate this. It's I'm having a student teacher conference and I don't know why, like there's kitty cat whiskers on my face while I'm talking something very, very stern and important about my child's development. It's like, how the hell do I get this off? I still remember like, I was testing out something where some sort of video thing. And so I tested out like two nights, one night, and okay, it's not really that great, but okay, I turned it off. I like quit the app, and then it reactivated itself while I was in a conference with somebody, and it's like I was so freaking furious with that app because like it started imposing itself on. It wasn't like it did anything really super embarrassing, but it's like okay, there is now a watermark and a whole bunch of text on the screen that I didn't ask to be there, and it doesn't. And there isn't like a button that says, hi, turn all of this off right now, immediately. And I had to basically dump out of the meeting. And then I put something on Twitter at the time that was, wow, this app is a total piece of crap. At least what I actually did. Granted, I could have cooled off before I said this app was a total piece of crap. But I only use the total piece of crap designation when a piece of software or service totally just steps on a rake and I'm the person who gets hit in the nose.
Did you have like a little icon of a boy peeing on a logo or something?
It was something similar to, it wasn't Camo Studio, but it was something similar to Camo Studio.
Camo does
like
that.
It was like three or four years ago where it was like, you know, create a lower third, put a graphic there. Mm-hmm. It's not like I said, Andy Notko, mass murderer, everyone who killed, like it was just like
it's embarrassing.
I don't want that there. I didn't ask you to put it there, and suddenly it's there, and I can't remove it. I'm glad that you've watermarked this with your software logo, so that I can say this piece of software is a complete piece of crap.
This is a case too where Apple is. I mean, I don't want to say out clevered itself because I don't think it has, but what it's done is it's hijacking the video and not the apps aren't involved and.
Yeah.
You get a bunch of clever things out of that, right? You get compatibility with everything. You get the system at a very base level is doing object, you know, image detection, subject detection, background detection. They can use that for all of these cool effects, for the portrait lighting, for the blurring the background. And then they've segmented the image so they can do the presentation stuff and they can do those animations that have multiple layers. Super clever, right? But it takes the app out of it. The apps don't really have any involvement, which is why I think maybe there should be an API of some kind so the apps can mirror those settings. And it's a break in sort of, on the Mac, it's a real break in kind of tradition where
right.
Even if you're a somewhat savvy user, you're looking in Zoom preferences and going, what is happening?
It seems much more like Zoom would be doing it.
Menu bar, but that's Apple last year, I think, decided they're going to roll a bunch of features that are global video and audio features, and they're going to put them in Control Center and now also in the menu bar when they're active. And like, it's a choice, and I get why it's there, but it's not a place where a lot of people have been trained to look. And that makes the confusion even worse because then those app developers hear it, right? Like, Zoom is like, what are you doing? And they're like, it's not us. It's Apple. Here's where you go. And like, I get it. It's frustrating.
Yeah. I think Photoshop does a pretty good job with this. Like every time there's a new feature, either in Photoshop or even in the mobile editing apps, it doesn't do things on its own, but when there's a context for me to use a new feature, it puts a little like pointer balloon say, oh, by the way, there are new selection tools with the new update, and you can activate them by hitting here. And I know that if I just don't tap anywhere else, it'll go away very quickly and it'll never come back again.
Apple has introduced in Sonoma, in fact, and in iOS, the latest iOS, TipKit, which it allows developers and Apple itself to do kind of contextual reminders. It's very clever. But I would say this is the challenge, because I was trying to think through is like, when do you tell people that there are new video effects? What's the right moment? Probably not while they're on a call. So not then. Yeah. So then when? Do you not do it? And then after they're off the call, then bring up a dialogue that says, hey, did you know we have these new things? Like, you could do that. It's hard, right? And if the answer is, well, no, just don't do it. Just never show it and have it off by default. Well, I don't know. Nobody's going to use that feature then, even if they would like it, because they don't know it's there. It's a hard problem. But in this case, Apple seems to have kind of failed at it.
Yeah. I don't know how often I would want to use those. Like, look at them. I mean, they're
just once. It's like Memojis. You're like, look at you use it a lot at first, and then you're done.
I use emojis all the time, I admit. But the
well, you're the only one.
No. No, I don't think so. That's again. I think that there's a lot of kids that
there's lots of people who will love this feature.
TikTokification. Yeah.
But Snapchatification. But I think that so for the mobile devices, having it on by default, I think makes sense. I think for the desktop, it is a little bit of a how many people on the desktop are jumping into meetings where they want to show fireworks. Whereas I felt like the right step app for Apple could have made is the Mac OS version tells you about it and lets you opt in, and the iOS versions just go ahead and turn it on, because I think that the type of person that's going to want to use this a lot is probably going to do it from their mobile device more often than from their desktop device. And they may not even have a desktop.
Yeah, you know who learned this lesson is Microsoft with Bob, right? It was so intrusive and so annoying and so cutesy, they actually had to take it out. And it's still to this day, you know, it's to their chagrin, frankly.
Yeah. It is such an interesting user interface problem. Like, companies that are trying to roll out really good chatbots and assistant AI in office-type apps are trying to figure out, do I put a sidebar in next to the work area that says, by the way, this is where the assistant lives. From time to time, it might make suggestions that, hey, here are things I can do for you right now. Ignore me if you want to ignore me, or even close down this panel if you want. But by default, it's going to be there, and which has got to be a better idea than like Clippy coming up and basically taking your attention away from you. Yeah. That was one of the big problems with it, because
it's terrible.
Again, and I mean, then we know a lot more about ADHD than we did like back in the 90s. But like back then, that would have been almost a war crime to say, hi, I really need to focus on getting through these 90 emails. Like, well, hi, look at me. I'm the cartoon eyeball guy. Here's 18 other things you could do instead of replying to this email that your boss says he needs an answer to in the next 6 minutes. Like, thank you, Clippy. Clippy, can you help me find a cardboard box to put everything on my desk in, as HR has just said that I need to do?
And then, of course, as Paul Thurrott points out, if you turned it off, it had a sad little dog that walked off and looked over his shoulder at you reproachfully, as if,
And you know how many meetings it took to decide that too? Like, what is it going to do? There was like months of meetings, and there was animation tests, and there was, you know, like,
it's a really hard problem.
Their product managers refer to that was my baby. I had the vision for it. You know, they didn't want to give them like lifelike eyeballs that follow the cursor, but I'm the one to put my foot down and say, well, if we're not doing the magic eyeballs, why are we even in this business?
Let's not forget that the woman who created Microsoft, Bob, was the product manager for it, ended up marrying Bill Gates. So she got her, I almost said reward, but now I'm thinking maybe she got her punishment. Yeah,
I think that the thing that I think it stands out for Apple, because in general, when thinking about this, are we going to push a product forward? Or are we going to have it be something that the user chooses? Apple usually picks the user. I think that it feels like it stands out a little bit, a little step forward, because, you know, I know a lot of times when we think about interfaces, when I'm building interfaces, we think about like, when do we show the user something? And usually it's when they, after they've already gotten what they needed. And then after that, I'm going to show you something that you could get that's a little bit more. But I don't force it on you ahead of time.
It's still hard.
Hey, this is,
there's no good time, I think. And I am sure Apple, you know, who reads that? Hey, you just got Mac OS Sonoma. Look at all the new features. Who reads that? Nobody. Mm-hmm. But I bet it was in there.
I think the first time you do a video connection in Sonoma, it brings up a thing that says, here are a bunch of things you can do. You can do, and it's not just these reactions, right? It's also the blurred background and the portrait studio in the foreground and all sorts of stuff.
Everything right. Yeah, let me try studio light.
Well, I mean, I think the catch is, maybe what Alex is saying, like when you first initiate it, you're probably about to go on a video conference. So you don't want it. It's in your way. It's a barrier to your destination. So
on the desktop.
Almost want to do is have it be after the video conference, right? Like after your video conference is over, put up a thing that said, hey, Apple here. Hi, we have some new features you might be interested in now that your video is done for the next video to make yourself look better. You look fine, by the way, you look fine, but we could help you even make it look better. Join us in the green box where we're going to tell you about all these new features, right? They could do it then, and that would probably be the best, but it's hard, right? Because, you know, turning it on means people will actually try it and they can turn it off if they don't like it. But if you don't turn it on, I firmly believe they know.
No one will ever.
People just will never find it.
I think it needs to start out with, you look marvelous.
You look marvelous.
Marvelous. But you could look more marvelous.
Help me. So let me turn on studio light. Give me a full screen, if you would. There we go. This, to me, this looks better, but maybe that's because I'm looking at a little thumbnail. Do you like that better than not?
Yeah, I mean, it's really nice.
I think it looks good.
And then you had a little
subject detection there, too, I thought.
Well, if I do the portrait, unfortunately, it looks like I'm on a green screen now. That has a very
I will say that Apple does that better than almost everybody else.
Yeah. So you know what? Look how good this is.
It's a much. I mean, and the reason is that it's not. It's the edges are probably a little better, but what really makes the difference is that it doesn't blur it as much. So it's. I wish that what Apple should do there is somewhere have a thing where you can turn the open and close the focal length.
Oh, they do.
Do they? Okay.
Yeah. And if you're, you can adjust it. Those settings are all adjustable now, which they didn't used to be.
This is actually great. You know what? Okay, I want to play with this for a while.
The you guys, metal video talk amongst yourselves. Is so good. They did such a good job with it. And I think maybe they're with the reactions. They got run.
It's pretty subtle. Away.
They're like, but it's, and then if you haven't done the presentation stuff, the screen sharing stuff is bananas, where you can be in a little circle while you're presenting video or a window to somebody. And it's like, and your head pops out of the circle because it's just like, why? Why did you do that? And the answer is because we have segmented video now at the system level, and we know that's you are really in the foreground and we know what your background is, and we can do all these things with it. And no app has to do anything. That's the funny thing, right? It's like the apps don't need to do anything to get these features. But like I said before, might be nice if you let them integrate your features into their interface, because like first thing, if you've got something weird going on in Zoom, first thing you're going to look is in the toolbar, then you're going to look in preferences in Zoom,
right?
You're probably not going to look in the menu bar. Wouldn't it be nice if Zoom could have a reactions button that was literally just toggling Apple's reactions button, but in a place where the users could see it? I think that might be something they could do.
Here's a little field research. So I noticed there was this mic mode has standard and then voice isolation. And that's an Apple feature. It's in Sonoma. It's right under all those other features. I turn it on, and then Zoom popped up a thing saying, hey, you know, that voice isolation isn't as good with the original sound setting you're using. So Zoom knows when those go on.
Yes.
And clearly to avoid calls to their tech support.
Well, you don't want to have like a double isolation you turn on natural sound and then in the system setting you turn it off again. It's
so
like,
Zoom could
stop fighting.
Have a thing that says, oh, you know, I noticed you've got reactions going, and maybe you shouldn't do that. And we are going to get rain later,
it's
Andy.
Terrible.
Right? I think this is. Oh my God! It's here. It's already.
It does look like it's fixing.
It's a fixing to rain. And I'm going to leave, Alex. Now you tell me if I'm making a mistake, but I'm going to leave the studio lighting.
You know, the hard part. The studio light, I think, is fine. I think that
not the portrait.
The problem is the edges. So yeah, you know.
See, that's normal.
And yeah, the edges are light.
I don't know what it's dimming your background and brightening your
foreground. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay, so I got my portrait on now.
Yeah. See, it's ugly. I don't like that.
See, but part of the problem is that like they still haven't figured out how to deal with like headphone gaps.
Yeah.
Not that I'm complaining. It's a modern miracle, but it's like
Wednesday on This Week in Google, Glenn Fleischman had one of those microphone pop filters that has a little arm, and the arm disappeared, and it looked like he had a floating pop filter. We almost contacted him.
Where do I get those on Amazon? Those are good.
I like that.
I mean, occlusion is always a really complicated problem, and I think that eventually we're going to see LiDAR added to the.
Oh,
I think you're
going
to see LiDAR added to your laptop. You know, into all the Apple products. I think that they probably commoditize that cost enough that they could probably within the next year or two add LiDAR to that process, because it's a much more accurate sampling at that
also
point.
The ML models are getting so much better than that. I mean, remember how bad portrait mode was originally in terms of all those you put your hands on your hips and there's it's a portal through which everything is clear even though on the outside it's blurry, and just the ML models have gotten so much better.
It's hard you know, on a day-to-day basis. I mean, it's one thing when you do it when you're traveling or something like that. I think that people who get used to doing it ongoingly, what we have found is that a lot of what people attribute Zoom fatigue is very closely connected to the quality of the audio and things like virtual backgrounds. Because there's something about, so when you see someone's edge moving and they see occlusion coming in and out, your brain is actively noticing that and then actively ignoring it, and it's creating load. You know, so there's a lot of cognitive load that's being added to that process. And the same thing when you're trying to listen to people. Like I find, especially right now with all the news that's going on right now, and they're interviewing all these people at their house, I'm like, you are a pundit.
It's terrible. It is embarrassing.
Like it is just like, what is wrong with you?
But we have come so far. I used to do CNN hits. They said, well, you got to come down to San Francisco for our satellite bureau so that we can mic you and stuff. And you had the earpiece and you had,
so bad.
And now they've got just people in their living rooms. There's people in their kitchens. You see stuff going on.
But for the broadcasters who don't do something about like actually at least.
I think if you're a regular, you should. But that's up to CNN to send them the box that you send your.
It's
people.
Just not telling them. Like we have had, I can't tell you how many people we've brought onto our show, onto Michael Krasny's show or other shows that we've done where we're working with them. We've worked with probably 5 or 6,000 people at this point. People who, and the first thing they'll tell us is, I do this all the time. You know, like, I know how this works. And you're like, no, this is going to be that hill. the hill I do this all the time.
No,
and you
I know
do
how
it
works.
Badly all the time. And
earbuds
and
are fine. Like, earbuds are fine. They work great. Everybody loves them.
Yeah. And the thing is that what helps is that we come in with these mics and they sound, and we go, let's play this back for you so you can hear me and you.
Oh, that's a good
And then
idea.
They go, And
poor Burke has to do sound checks for everybody on our shows.
Right.
And we always get people who say, no, I can't do that. I'm too busy. But don't worry, I've got it all set up. And invariably, they're the ones we spend half an hour on Twit dicking around with their sound because it's terrible.
Right. Well, and the thing is that the broadcasters don't tell them. They have them there for a minute. They don't want them to think about it. They don't
want to deal
with it. And so, like,
PBS does. PBS tells you, believe me.
That's great. Because there's like, we've probably had at least 50 people who are on broadcast all the time over the last 5 years who literally told us, no one told me. No one told me I didn't sound good.
And if you play it for them and they get it, it's really valuable, actually. Because nobody wants to sound bad.
Right. Yeah.
They just don't. You can't tell when you're sitting here doing it.
And it's, think, you know, it's a pain to sit, you know, like we send out mics. I've got like four or five mics that float around the world, you know, right. like for Michael Krasny's show that are just where they're coming in.
Oh, that's
getting
interesting.
Refreshed. They're getting,
cause that's out. Audio only that show.
It's
right?
it. No, we do a video live stream for subscribers and then okay. the non-subscribers just hear the podcast. Mm-hmm.
You can tell which I am.
I think you have to get people like familiar with the idea that it's okay if the microphone is in the shot. Because if the microphone is in the shot, you've got nine tenths of your problems are solved. As opposed to no.
What happened at the beginning of the show? Alex said, "Your microphone, where is it?
Yeah, where is it? At?
You
yeah,
sound terrible. On. Where is your microphone?" I said, "I have some cookbooks. It's here."
Well, and I tell
microphones
people,
microphones and lights, they need to be right near your face. That's what, if there's one sentence out. You can give people that will fix a lot of the problems. It's
yeah, and I put my mic in front of me so that people. Sell the idea that everybody can just have a mic in front of them.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Although I have to say, lately when I'm watching the news channels. There is a look, and you always know a guy's a podcaster because he's got big headphones on. He's got a big microphone in his face. And now joining us from the podcast, Who Believes in Witches? And you always know because there's a look, right? And I honestly,
fine,
I think
I'll get
take,
some earbuds. I know I got some.
Should,
some
no, I think we should take credit for that. I think we created that look. I think that's part we of did. The Twit
no,
ethos.
It's being normalized. You know I can't remember his name. Oh, Stephen Colbert. He tested positive for COVID. He's not sick. He just tested positive. So he had to do the show from his house. And even then, like he has no problem saying, I'm going to be wearing wearing over the ear headphones.
Yeah.
He had a nice microphone in front of him. Yeah.
Yeah.
People understand that this is, it's weird that, cause now everybody knows somebody who's a broadcaster now. It's basically like having a family member. No, it's truly cause now the idea that what used to be this miraculous thing where my God, your audio is so good. How did you do it? And everyone knows. Oh, you must have went to Home Depot and you last October because they had them on sale. And everybody has a nice microphone now. Or excuse me, more people than you would think have a nice microphone or a ring light now.
And the funny thing is that, and I do really think the undermining of people's belief in the press and in their leadership, in the country leadership, is very connected to the quality. Of what they do on air. And when they bring these pundits in over, you know, and they're sounding horrible. I mean, there was like a day or two ago, we were passing it around. We passed videos around of like, this is amazingly bad.
You're the worst.
And there was a former, I can't think which one it was, but it was like the former defense secretary talking about something and lighting was done perfectly. And it was a big echoey room, and he was obviously using the built-in mic. And you were like, "What are you doing?" Like you know. And I think that people don't know. Here's the worst part. The thing that's scary, the scariest part of this, is that people make decisions in their subconscious, in their lower brain, about you, and they're not even conscious.
Oh yeah, they don't know why.
They just know that they don't really believe you anymore. And I think I think that anybody listening.
Well, you know what happened on that one. The his aide came up and said, "Mr. Secretary, here's your headset for the," and he says, "I'm not going to wear that."
Oh no! I think that they just someone in his group because
doesn't know better.
They obviously spent time on his lighting and his camera, so he had a web camera, but he obviously spent time on it. They just didn't. It was just not an audio person. Right. And I'm like the thing that we worry about on ours is, do you have wired internet? Like that's the number one. Like you know, because of the amount of filtering I have to, the amount of fixes we have to do if you start taking Wi-Fi hits. You know, is a big deal. And they're like, "Well, I got a 1 gig connection." I'm like, it doesn't matter.
No.
You know, it's how many devices are moving in and out of your space. That's all it
just
matters.
Just say, I always use the secret magic witch word, jitter. You say, "Well, yes, but your jitter is terrible." And then they don't know any better because they go, "Well, I don't know. What, my jitter? Oh, my God. What am I going to do?"
Well, and then I'm like, and then it's the mic. You know, and it's like, those are the two. And then after that, we worry about lighting. Because lighting will make every camera better,
right?
And then camera, and then background. You know, like we just kind of stack down those.
That's the priority.
That's how we work through the priorities. But so many people will, at best, you'll get them to pay attention to their camera, and they don't realize that what we're listening to and what you know, especially at talking head, is your voice.
There's a bit of a backlash against Room Raider on X. Formerly known as Twitter, because he's just rating the backgrounds. And so a lot of people are getting 5 out of 5 on Room Raider when they really should be getting much lower scores. You need to do that, Alex. You should be the new...
I'm, When I first started in Pixel Core, you'll see some of these, the teardowns. I used to tear down
those.
Broadcast.
We love those.
I know. I got to get back. I've got it all set up, and I just, anyway, but the...
You have need a nickname like Nasty Alex.
The Mr. Blackwell.
Mr. Blackwell. That's it. Simon Cowell. I mean,
Look at this.
30 frames per second is so 2009.
People love that. Yeah. You could be the, who's the chef? The Gordon Ramsay of video.
How about this?
That video stinks. You should go and get a job in garbage collection.
Don't get it. I've always wanted this thing, this black and white, for some reason, I've always thought this black and white of someone throwing a television, like just angry, like just somewhere. I haven't found it yet. I think I might go shoot it myself. Like,
we've got a new career. Room Tone Raiders right out there.
Room Tone Raiders. That's it. Oh, yeah. I love
Tone
it.
Opening titles of SCTV. Just grab it. Just steal it. High-rise apartment building with everybody in the building throwing their TVs out the window.
That's right. It all comes back to Second City.
But I do think that, you know, like I started with broadcast because I didn't want the online people to feel like I was picking on them. Then I stopped doing it because I ran out. Anyway, I'm definitely thinking about turning that thing back on, mostly just to, you know, shame and ridicule people.
Patrick Delahanty.
There should be somebody at a network who says... who's in charge of upping the game of the people they have as their contributors, who's sending them equipment. I'm sure there was during COVID lockdown, but they're asleep on the job now is what's happening.
Well, Alex, I remember the day you showed us the Oprah kit that they would send out to get people on Skype. And it was a big trunk of equipment and gear. John Ashley, the Discord. Patrick Delahanty's posted that wonderful Mythic Quest. The best episode of Mythic Quest was the COVID season where they did a whole show from Skype, and the great F. Murray Abraham played a kind of a drunk game designer who I don't think he can you show that John Ashley. I don't think he really got the Skype thing. You don't have that up.
But anyway, it's just it. It's I know we've done a little lot, but the it is amazing.
We'll add it in post. We'll fix it in post.
Exactly. Yeah, okay. Yeah. It's amazing how off the broadcasters and again the online creators, doing all of our individual podcasts and everybody else, we've all figured it out. and the broadcasters are the ones that are kind of left behind, you know. And
yeah.
Oh. Oh, that's hilarious.
Has the meeting started? Has the meeting started?
That's how he lives.
All right, let's take a little break. I'm sure the Hannah Waddington holiday special will appear in the next segment.
Waddingham?
I don't know. I don't watch the show.
Waddingham.
New Englanders would say Waddingham.
Waddingham. She says Waddingham.
Leominster.
Waddingham.
Waddingham. How does she say it?
I think Waddingham, probably.
Waddingham.
But Hannah not Waddington.
Holiday special.
Only
next.
From about 6 feet in the air.
Waddingham.
That's
our show today brought to you by Delete Me. Have you... this is the time for Delete Me. We see this all the time. 23andMe got bit by a credential stuffing thing because there was a breach and passwords got out. And the problem is this. Have you ever searched for your name online? Do you see? In fact, don't do this. If you haven't done it, don't. But if you have, you know, you see all this stuff. You're like your home address, what your house is worth, how much you make. It makes you feel exposed and it should make you feel unsafe. And if you are an executive in a company, it should terrify you. That's why you need Delete Me. Since 2010, Delete Me has been on a mission to empower individuals and organizations, allowing them to reclaim their privacy and help remove personal data from online sources. A lot of these breaches happen because of a phishing attack. We've had it happen to us where somebody gets our org chart, you know, from brokers or so forth, figures out where everybody is, what their phone numbers are, and started texting employees purporting to be from the CEO, from Lisa, saying, hey, I'm in a meeting right now. I'm too busy. Can you get me this information? Now, fortunately, our employees are pretty sophisticated. They did not fall for it. But you can imagine in your organization, there's going to be one or two who would say, oh, yes, sir, right away. We'll get that right out to you. And the way they're able to do that is because they can deduce everybody, you know, they just look people's names, addresses, phone numbers up. They get your org chart. They figure out who reports to whom. They've got the phone number. And the rest is easy. The rest is just social engineering. This is why you need DeleteMe. In fact, it's why we use DeleteMe. Our executives use DeleteMe to reduce risk from, you know, cybersecurity threats, identity theft, credit card fraud. It also helps with robocalls. If you're getting spam, texts, harassment, unwanted communications, this is why you need DeleteMe. DeleteMe's team is driven by a passion for privacy, just like us, right? And a commitment to make it simple for customers to use. It's the most trusted privacy solution available. Lisa's been using it for more than a year, and it has really, it's amazing. It's really worked. It's DeleteMe has helped thousands of customers remove their PII, their personal information, online. The average person, this is scary, has more than 2,000 pieces of data about them online. DeleteMe can find it and remove it. Now, you could, I think maybe some of you say, well, I could do that. Just go around to the brokers, right? Do you know how many brokers there are? And there are more every day. There are hundreds and hundreds of data brokers out there, all of whom are collecting your information, selling it on to anybody, to the highest bidder. One customer used DeleteMe said, I signed up. They took it from there. Awesome service. Already seeing results. We have absolutely seen the results. And, I think when we were targeted like that, that was the wake-up call. That was like, oh, yeah, yeah. We got to keep people's information offline, right? First, here's how it works. You're going to sign up. You will have to submit to DeleteMe, but you can trust them some basic information because they have to know what to remove. They need to know what to be looking for, right? Then their experts go out. They find your personal information. They search literally hundreds of data brokers. And they issue a request, take it down. Now, they have to adhere to that, by the way, which is good news. In fact, in California, there's a new bill that says that'll happen starting next year. But thanks to GDPR and regulations in other states, those data brokers have to listen. But they've got it. They're sneaky. And a lot of times they take it down and 3 weeks later, it's back. Oh, well, we got it from another source. You didn't mention that. So this is what's so cool about DeleteMe. Once it starts, you're going to get your DeleteMe report within 7 days. This is what we've done. But DeleteMe will continue to scan and remove personal information every 3 months. In fact, they have automated removal opt-out monitoring that goes out and says, okay, we did this removal request. We opted out for you. And then they go back and check because these guys are sleazy. They not DeleteMe, the brokers, they'll put it back up. So they make sure records don't get repopulated after the stuff's taken down. And you got to do that. This is why you can't really do it yourself, not unless you have a lot of time. As the data broker industry evolves, DeleteMe is always adding new sites, new features to ensure their service is simple to use and is effective in removing PII, personally identifiable information, from the internet. And it really works. By the way, they have privacy advisors. I highly recommend because these incidents and exposures affect different people differently. Their privacy advisors will ensure that all of their customers have the support that you need when they need it. Sometimes it's just a shoulder to cry on. You're like, how did they find this out? How do they know this? And your privacy advisor can explain and then help you get rid of it. Protect yourself, reclaim your privacy. The website is joindeleteme.com/twit. Use the code twit, please. Joindeleteme.com/twit. The slash twit's important. In fact, use the code twit for 20% off. So do that because then they know that you saw it here and that helps us. Joindeleteme.com/twit. We know from personal experience it really works. And we frankly also know that you really need to do it, especially for your company. Your executives, your managers, your bosses, they all need to be doing this. And your employees too, frankly. Joindeleteme.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of our show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, prepare yourself for Hannah Waddington's holiday. Sorry, Waddingham. Never mind. I'll never get it. she's the team owner, right? Yeah. I like her because you know why I like her? Because she's attractive, she's sexy, and she's an older woman. And it makes us old folks feel better. Like,
oh, also her character was like exactly the sort on the show was exactly the sort of thing. If you want to become a star and have all people like really like you a lot, she was a very, very likable character. And then she was the host of the Eurovision this year. And
she was great on that.
And she really took off. Like, everyone was like, speaks, oh my God, she's wonderful. Why don't we not see more of her?
She speaks French. Yes.
I watched Ted Lasso. I finally got pulled into Ted Lasso because I had to see what she was really like in that show.
Yes, she's
because of Eurovision.
Show.
I mean, she's so talented.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so funny and just so amazing.
When she eats those shortbread cookies, she really makes them look good.
And they're apparently very bad, actually.
Really?
Cookies that are on the set. She said they taste like salt and they're terrible.
Well, that's exactly prop food. Yeah.
So she's an even better cookies. Actor than I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. She makes them look so good. Anyway, Hannah Waddingham, or Ham, but not Ton.
Not Ton.
Not Ton. Anything but Ton. Hannah Waddingham, Home for Christmas. It was recorded live. I guess it was. It's not going to be live, but it was recorded live in front of an audience at the London Coliseum November 22nd on Apple TV. Yeah. Plus, there'll be a big band. There'll be special guests.
It's a variety show.
I gotta say, it's the official picture they released that got me excited about.
Woo! She looks good.
Not just that, but like again, this is Generation X talking. But we're old enough to remember like the TV celebrity packed like Christmas specials from the old days, where it wasn't like the people weren't. These days they're too cool to like, oh, we're gonna have a set in which like I'm just inviting you here to my Christmas ranch, and Kenny Loggins is going to be here to sing. I'm going to be there in a big glitzy dress with a big like Christmassy backdrop orchestra, and we're just going to have a whole bunch of guests come on, banter, and then sing the hell out of a song, and then maybe you know there'll be a little skit or two. I don't know. I just there all this the, thing where anything could happen. That I want the some only Christmas thing, joy, and I think that she's capable of being the MC of such a show for me now.
I think the picture looks fabulous. The thing that worries me, it's being produced by the same people who did Mariah Carey's Magical Christmas Special, which was a complete car wreck. I don't know if you watched it. Don't worry, it'll be back this year.
It's a redemption arc. It's perfect reality TV.
Anyway, she's also Ms. Waddingham is also going to be in the big screen flick, The Fall Guy. I guess the movie version of The Fall Guy with Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt. Wait a minute, what was The Fall Guy? He was a stuntman, right?
Yeah,
he was man.
Wasn't he a stuntman?
Was it Lee Majors?
Kiss and tell, but I've been seen with Farrah. Lee Majors.
Gen X energy going hard here now. Yeah.
Because I'm the unknown stuntman who makes Eastwood look so fine.
I don't remember that theme song, but I'm thinking that's real.
That's what I remember instead of Calculus.
I'm the unknown stuntman. Oh, yeah. Real stuff. That's real. That was Lee Majors after... after the $6 Million Man. And yes, there is a line about how he was seen with Farrah, which is funny because he was married to Farrah.
He was married to her. Wow. Yeah, no. A little in joke.
Farrah Fawcett Majors. That's right.
And the thing is, both of those people were too big stars, too big of a stars to have be like conglomerated into like a fair may, like as they wouldn't in these days.
Well, more modern.
You got your $6 Million Man. You got your Charlie's Angels detective. I can't remember what her name was, but still.
My favorite. Now we might want a special gesture on your camera for this one. The Goldman Sachs unidentified Goldman Sachs partner who says of the Apple car, we should have never done this effing thing. Actually, Goldman had earnings this quarter, $2 billion, which makes everybody very happy. But they have really been fighting. They're in all of their consumer products, and they really want to get out of the Apple Card. They sold their personal loan app, Green Sky, at a big loss. They bought it just last year. They have, you know, we've heard this several times that they've been shopping the Apple Card business to American Express. One little problem, Apple Card's a MasterCard. That's a little problem. American Express has been kind of looking at it. I don't know how, but somehow Goldman Sachs manages to lose money on the Apple Card. They also have a General Motors credit card. They want to get out of all the consumer business.
Consumer businesses are hard. Like dealing with individuals with tiny little accounts compared to commercial accounts and, right. and industrial accounts and so on and so forth is really hard. And, you know, I think they saw an opportunity to work with Apple. They saw an opportunity to go into a new market, and especially doing it at the level that Apple expects it, I think is the other problem, is that it's really hard and it's exceptionally hard to do it the way Apple wants to do it.
And the Wall Street Journal says
it's brutal.
That one of the reasons Amex, American Express, is reluctant to buy the Apple Card is because of its losses. It's it's high. Not that the business loses money. I'm not sure about that, but the loss rates. So there are a lot of people stiffing Apple at this point. And of course, when they do that, it really is Goldman Sachs they're stiffing.
Yeah. And they're also, the Wall Street Journal, this is the second article they've had with insiders talking about how bad this deal was, or how much bad will there is inside Goldman Sachs. And this one was interesting because it's talking about some details that Apple was insisting on that seemed more like esoteric style things. Like, no, everyone gets their bill on the same day every month. And some executives were talking about how, like, well, that means that we have this huge crunch inside the office on the same day, whereas on every other credit product, we spread them out across the month. So basically, we have this totally artificial work crunch that we have to deal with. That if not for Apple's stylistic preference of no, we have to have Apple. We're painting the side of the fence that people don't see as well, and that takes as much. Yeah, but some things make an office run more smoothly.
Well, what happens when you partner with somebody who has no experience in this business, right? Yeah. I might have said that. You know, it'd be great if the credit card bill came the first of every month, and you don't think about the consequences. But, and obviously, somebody who's been doing credit cards would say,
Apple. It's not Apple doesn't have experience. Apple does this all the time in many other places.
Yes,
it's not out of inexperience. It's out of this is how we live our life.
It would be awesome if you guys did that and we didn't have to do it ourselves.
It cuts both ways too, right? Because like, how do you get? Because sometimes you have an entrenched market, and they're like, well, we do it this way, and the answer is, well, why do you do it that way? Is it because it's more convenient for your customers? And it's like, oh no, it's less convenient for them, but it's more convenient for us.
Right.
And Apple goes in and says, no, let's prioritize the customer. We're going to do it this way. And like, you can affect change and make a better product that way. But you're right, Leo. I mean, when I worked at IDG, I went through like 8 managers in about 2 years, where every one of them rolled in and said, we're going to reinvent this. I've got some ideas. And I would be like, okay, let me tell you, this isn't true. You're wrong about this. This won't work than this. And then I realized after the fourth one or whatever that I just needed to give them 6 months to realize everything that I told them was right, and then they would figure it out. So that's the truth of it too. And
the problem is, after 6 months, there's somebody else.
There's somebody else. So yeah.
You got to do it all over.
Later, they're gone. You train them, and then you lose them. It's just it's brutal to manage up when they keep changing the. Yeah, Apple is. Everybody wants to work with Apple, but then the reality hits of this, and this is doubled. I mean, it is funny. The Journal writes about this because clearly they have people inside Goldman Sachs who are like, "Help us, get us out of here," and they went into this business, this consumer business that they just don't. As a company, want to be in, and you know they're trying to escape, and you know Apple's holding them. It feels like one of these things where Apple's holding them to the letter of their contract at this point, which is fine, except that's a bad relationship to be in, and it is going to end at some point. And so you've got to be thinking like, where do we go from here with this? Because clearly this partnership isn't working.
So even the Apple Savings account, which has been a huge success, I think I have a couple of $1,000s in there. Has quickly attracted billions in deposits, according to the Wall Street Journal. Not all Goldman executives are thrilled about that. Goldman had placed a cap on the amount of deposits it would accept for the Apple account, according to people familiar with the matter. It surpassed that figure within a few weeks. They increased the cap again, but it's close to hitting it again. Now, I mean, I think that's free money for Goldman, but... the problem is bank executives are saying these high balances are going to make it very hard for us to separate from Apple because if the Apple partnership moves, all those billions of dollars in savings accounts that Goldman now has as cash are going to move with it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is I think Apple has contracts. I think what Goldman, at least, you know, it's interesting that this has appeared now twice in the Wall Street Journal in 6 months. I feel like somebody in Goldman keeps planting this story.
Or just everyone's so freaking upset at the first of every month that there's a lot of bad blood.
Yeah, maybe. According to people who are really pissed off about this. But of course, the hook on this one is the Goldman partner who said, we should never have done this effing thing, which reminds me a lot of the AT&T CEO, remember? Yeah. Yep. Who made the deal with Apple to have the exclusive on the iPhone. And part of the deal, Apple said, well, you know, have to have unlimited data. And what was his name? I've forgotten his
Randall
name.
Randall Stephenson?
Randall Stephenson said it was the worst thing we've ever done. We have lost so much money on that deal.
But nonetheless, yeah. Like the other part of that was, remember that at the time, AT&T had just gone back to yet another rebranding. They were AT&T Mobile, then they were Singular, and then they switched back to AT&T.
Right.
They were struggling to be a really big force against Verizon, which was the 800-pound gorilla. I think that I remember hearing other executives basically saying that, yeah, it was a pain in the butt, but the reason why we gave Apple everything they asked for was because this was a way to get more people signed up for AT&T, and now that's why it's a two-party system, right?
I think that if AT&T calculated the benefits over X number of years, and subscribers over that, and what they gained from that, I think they did okay.
Yeah, that's exactly what we saw in the testimony with the Department of Justice antitrust case against Google, where Microsoft's CEO and other executives were saying that we were willing to take a multi-billion-dollar loss on a deal to supplant Google Search as the default search engine if Bing could default that, because we felt that just getting in front of that many people was worth that loss. We could eat that. We could make more money. We can't necessarily make people become users of Bing at this rate.
Does the iPhone 15 Pro cost more to make? The bill, they call it the bomb, the bill of materials. And according to Apple Insider, the iPhone 15 Pro Max costs 12% more to make than its predecessor. They're actually quoting a teardown from Nihon Keizai Shimbun and the formal house Techno Solutions of Japan. Nikkei says the bill of materials for the Pro Max is $558. That's actually kind of interesting. It's a 47% parts to cost ratio. It's pretty high.
I think that the declaration of accuracy is well beyond the precision of what they're talking about. I think that to say that it's $558, there's so many other things that are part of that cost analysis that they're not taking into account. How the goods that go back, the things that don't work, some of the efficiencies. When people say go down to a dollar, if you're outside the system,
predicting
that you can do plus or minus $50, at best, I think that it's a,
in some ways it is an apples to apples comparison, because they're comparing it to their bill of materials that they calculated from last year.
They made up.
Exactly.
From last year. Well, they didn't.
Okay. My made up number and my other made up number are $12 different, are 12% different.
Well, they don't necessarily it's speculative. I would say speculative rather than made up, because of course they're not going to email Apple and say, hi, can you tell us, can you give us the receipts from your manufacturing?
I would like to buy one.
Yeah, exactly. A list of everything you need.
For one A17 chip? I'm just asking.
But the thing is, this isn't just a tabloid tech reporter trying to get clicks. There's a lot of money that changes hands based on the financials of what these would go. So basically, it is significant. If the same team using the same metrics and the same sources from one year to another says that our numbers for this model are higher than last year's model, you can't believe the actual number, but that is a data point that's significant. Nikkei also had a story that I just saw a couple of days ago about their saying about the A17 Pro chip that uses the new 3-nanometer process. They're putting it as costing about 27% more than the A16 Bionic last year cost. They're saying cost $130 to make, but they're also saying that they compared it to their numbers for the Snapdragon 8 Gen 2, which is, they're saying, is 23% more expensive than that. So it's interesting when you think that if they're thinking that the entire unit costs $500 some odd dollars, the idea that just the silicon could cost $130 of that tells you a lot about like how much on lock they've got all these previous technologies done, how much on lock they've got other manufacturing processes done, and that every time they roll out a brand new process, I think Jason hinted at this before with the Apple Pencil, that once you've made the millionth of something, you know how to get this price way down. And when you make the next generation of it, you know how to cut that cost of manufacture down even further. When you make the first million of first thousand of something, you're on brand new ground and you haven't economized anywhere.
I should have asked this at the beginning of the show. Is that it? Is that all there is? Is that all there is to a circus? No, is that all there is to Apple's announcements for the rest of the year? That pathetic pencil. Are we gonna see them?
Probably.
I think they were gonna do anything else, they would have said it, right?
Yeah. Well, they might do. Sometimes they do the thing where it's like, well, this is our iPad announcement, and the next Tuesday we'll do another one. Like I would say it's not impossible that something like an iMac might be announced next Tuesday, but it sort of feels like they're at the end.
If they don't do it next Tuesday, they're not going to, because then it's Halloween and you never want to announce something on Halloween. Yeah. And then it's November and it's too late.
I think November 17th, I think, is about the last day
really
that you could do it.
So they could do something next month.
They've done stuff before Thanksgiving. They've done stuff in the first couple of weeks. I don't know if they will, but they have.
Traditionally, you say get it done by the end of October because you've got to fill the channel. But I guess Apple, because they run the stores, they don't have to worry as much about getting it to Macy's.
Yeah, I think that again they have the latest they've done is right before Thanksgiving. After Thanksgiving, Apple kind of shut. You know, the next one.
Oh yeah, there's nothing after
end
that.
Of February is the first time you'll see.
Well, you got to get out by Black Friday. I mean, that's the shopping day, right?
And not only that, but you really got to accept that China's going to be shut down for the New Year's celebration. So that's another black hole. I mean, I still want to believe there's going to be a new iPad, or at least a new iPad Mini, but an Apple Pencil coming out just as a lone straggler announcement. Like, oh, okay, that would have been a perfect thing to tag on to. Oh, and by the way, we've listened to people who love the Apple Pencil, but they wish we're a little bit more affordable. And so now we're introducing one more thing. So, okay, I guess I'm finding it harder to, if Apple comes up with another announcement before the end of the year, I'm not going to be able to predict what it is, because it could be anything and it's probably going to be nothing.
All right. I'm just getting my hopes up, but I guess.
Yeah, me too. Cause I am so jonesing for a new iPad Mini. I can't even tell you. I mean, it's almost as if they know that if there are so many people like me that are 3 months ago were like, I'd be interested. Sure. Then the longer they make us hold out, the more like, as soon as it comes in, I'm pre-ordering. I'm going to be demon dialing that phone number. I don't care if it's made out of marzipan. I'm going to have it.
Apple's, of course, tribute to Mother Nature, Octavia Spencer, was an interesting part, a long and interesting part of their last event. Stand Earth has come out with a report. I saw this in 9 to 5 Mac that compared the actual green credentials of Apple, Dell, Google, HP, Microsoft, and NVIDIA. Everyone but NVIDIA has pledged to reduce greenhouse gas emissions within supply chains by 2030, but Apple has the largest commitment. The headline is, Apple's green, not as green as they claim, but they still are better than anybody else. Apple's commitment, 75% of greenhouse gas emissions eliminated in the next, 7 years. Google, HP, and Microsoft say 50%. Dell says 45%. So, you know, I think that's kind of what we thought when we saw Octavia Spencer.
Yes.
They're doing the best. I mean, Greenpeace shortly thereafter said, well, if they really wanted to do their best, they'd stop trying to push people to buy new phones all the time. But sure, that's not going to happen. That's
okay.
Their business.
Okay, Susan. Okay. Yeah. It's marketing. It's a real commitment and a real belief wrapped in marketing, because that's Apple. That's how Apple rolls, right? Like Apple is never going to come out with like, I have here's a humble white paper. No, that's not it's never going to happen that way. And it's like, no, what? If we do a whole bit with Oscar-winning actors, and also a bunch of like comedy actors where you're like, hey, wait a second, isn't that, and we'll say that we're, but in the end, while it is marketing and therefore it is self-serving, it is also a real commitment. And if you look at the details, I was watching some sport football probably last weekend, and I noticed there was a an airline ad. Was it a Delta? And it was basically like, no, we're not killing the environment. We're great. Yeah. It's just like, actually, I'm not sure about that. And they said, no, we're committed to being carbon neutral. I'm like, whoa, an airline? How is it possible? By 2050? By 2050. Yeah.
You'll all be dead by then, so can say that now.
So, yeah, Apple's commitments are real and they're substantial, and I think that they are shaming other companies who are scrambling to resolve. But it's also marketing, and you should take everything they say with a grain of salt, because sometimes, like, I mean, I appreciated in that video that they said, we're doing carbon offsets, and somebody in the Mother Nature Brigade was like, yeah, but carbon offsets are kind of sketchy. And they're like, no, the good ones. And I thought that was good, right? Because they're trying to say, like, we're trying to do the right thing here. But in the end, it was still a marketing video. There's no doubt about it.
They're still a company in business. Yeah. And they can't very well say, well, you should really buy less of our products. That would be the best thing possible for the environment.
It's funny. I hear people being like, well, shouldn't the shareholders be angry that they're doing all this silly stuff? And it's like, no, you know, the truth is everybody is going to have to do this, and they are getting out ahead of it, and they are shaming other companies into doing it. And I think that in the end, it will be seen as a net benefit that Apple was out in front of this stuff, because it's that same Apple game, right? Where the next one to come along in 5 years is going to find out that it's potentially like more difficult for their business and more expensive for them to do it than it was for Apple to do it, because they did it up front.
And The Verge is pointing out that Apple is one of the few companies that is also pushing their suppliers and helping their suppliers with financial support.
They got a clout.
It's so much, as Jason said, it's so much easier to do this slowly than quickly, and it's going to get, you know, it's going to get more intense, you know, so it definitely makes sense for them to.
And they're also in a good spot to lead. I agree that I think they really do believe in this. They also believe that it's good marketing. As long as they're doing it, they're going to get good press out of it. But I do believe that that's a sincere belief, just like they sincerely believe in the health benefits that they're trying to promote through Apple Health. But they're also in a position where they are, all of their businesses are the kinds where it's easier to maximize your ecological moves. They're not like Microsoft, they're not like Amazon, they're not like Google, where so much of your profits come from data centers that have to consume more and more electricity. Google and Microsoft are going to be really, really going to have to deal with this, because all their business, they're investing so much in their business in AI models, and training these AI models and running them just costs an immense amount of energy, and sourcing it in clean ways, they're going to run out of real estate renewable energy sources nearby, and they're just going to have to say, you know what, the plant has to go here is in West Virginia, and the cheapest energy in West Virginia is coal. Sorry.
It's not going to fly, though. That's the thing. It's not going to fly. In the end, they're going to have to say, we're going to go by a river or right here by where the wind is, and we're going to do it there instead.
We have installed little shower stations free for all the little birdies if they get covered in soot and they want to just, you know, take a dirt bath or something. Mm-hmm. All out of pocket is what we're on that.
I'm sure you all play Honor of Kings, the fabulous 10-cent game that started in Chengdu and is now a global phenomenon in the App Store. I know that because that's what Tim Cook said on Weibo, the Chinese social media service. He actually went to China, went to an Apple store in Chengdu to cheer on gamers playing Honor of Kings in what CNBC was calling a surprise visit. Just like when a diplomat shows up in a war zone. It's the, I guess the iPhone 15 has been getting a somewhat lukewarm response in China. Sales down 4.5% compared to last year.
Yeah. They're number two behind Huawei now.
Yeah, according to estimates that are, I have no doubt that it's a little bit down.
It's all guesses.
The estimates are all, they're all guesses, and they're guesses in the China market. But there was a,
you know what makes that guess seem somewhat maybe more real is the fact that Tim flew to China to cheer on gamers. Hey, gamers, love it. Keep playing.
Well, and it's talking to the gamers. It's also the government going, hey, it'd be really good if we had some attention right now. You know, like, because there's a lot of things that we could do that you know, that could be more interesting. Apple is still pretty beholden to the Chinese government, and they're going to be, I think they're slowly trying to extract themselves out, but they're in a, they've got a little work to do there.
Look, Apple's committed. You get Tim Cook in a middle seat between a big guy and a little old lady, and he's flying to China for 12 hours. That's commitment. Oh, wait a minute. He's not. That was me. That was me on the middle seat. He's flying out here.
He's flying in one of those really green private jets, I think. The one that. I'm not going to give CEOs crap for like using private jets because they're kind of super, super valuable. But yeah, there's supposedly, I was trying to read more about this. He certainly didn't come there just for the esports tournament. Obviously, he was going to be meeting with government officials. I did see something that said that he's going to be speaking at some sort of a trade conference that I couldn't actually identify, but yeah, there's a lot of it's his CEO style that as he frustrated the hell out of me by trying to make sure he always talks to Trump when he was president, but that belies his philosophy of you talk to the people, you keep an open line of communication, you don't necessarily have to like berate people and bully people or say, okay, I'm going to turn my back to you. So he's basically being able to put in the FaceTime with China means that in an area in which things are kind of testy and vulnerable. Remember that there were some rumors like a month or two ago about the government's banning iPhones from government agencies. I don't think that turned out to be true, but there was a lot of people, at least in the China press, that were talking about that, at least being floated. He's a person who believes in if I have an hour or two in private talking to this person, at least they know that, hey, you don't have to simply by fiat make a declaration that kind of ruins part of our business. You can actually call me up on the phone and we can talk about it.
All right, I think we should take our final break and get your picks of the week. Is there any stories that I missed? Something they wanted to talk about? I think we got everything.
Hear about that new Apple Pencil?
Apple Pencil.
We covered that.
Almost missed that
big
one.
Big breaking news.
Hot story, yeah. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, your picks of the week. Security Now is coming up. The HTTP2 exploit will be the topic, and a hot topic it is with Steve Gibson in just a little bit. Our show today brought to you, and you probably noticed this whenever you're watching any of our shows, that ACI Learning signage. Who is ACI Learning? It's our friends at IT Pro TV. They're now called ACI Learning, and that's made them just even better for IT professionals, IT teams, and people who want to get into IT. IT teams significantly benefit from training from ACI Learning. They kept everything that made IT Pro TV just stand out. Engaging, entertaining, passionate instructors who are real experts in the field. Short form 20 to 30 minute content so you could watch it at a lunch break. Great for people getting into IT. They have all the certs you could possibly want to get that first job. Great for any team that needs to keep its chops up. IT Pro's expanded capabilities provide more support for IT teams. Their courses are the most up-to-date. They're so committed to this, they built 7 studios. In fact, Lisa and I visited them at the grand opening in Gainesville. And they're all live, running Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, because the certs change, the tests change, the software changes, new versions, stuff goes away, stuff gets introduced. So whether it's Microsoft's cloud, AWS, CompTIA, they've got the certs for all of it. One proud tech team leader said, get this, I had 110 engineers in the field. He's probably an MSP. I'm not sure. We had dozens of IT Pro accounts. Last year alone, they passed over 40 certs. And this stuff is so good that your employees will look forward to the training. I mean, how often can you say that? The industry's completion rate on training video, it's a sad, pathetic 50% or less. That means half the time people don't even finish the video. IT Pro is 80% completion rate. 80% completion rate. ACI Learning has nailed this. They make the best content that people want to watch. But there's more than that. Your team will love the practice labs, a great way to set up Windows servers and clients. You can even do it on a browser, on a Chromebook, an HTML5 browser, anywhere. So it's easy to do. But also MSPs often use it to test software, to test integrations before they roll it out in the field. That's fantastic. ACI Learning's practice tests allow pros to prepare for those CERT exams by taking the test before they take the test. It's so nice when you feel confident when you go into the actual test because you've gone through several iterations of practicing. So you know what the test is like, what the questions are like. You're ready. And it really adds, I think, to the performance. ACI Learning's new skills gap analysis tool is also fantastic. I mean, how do you know where the gaps are in your IT team? Well, Insights, that's the name of the tool, which is, by the way, powered by the magic of AI, will identify your team's weaknesses. It can provide management and individuals valuable assessments, assists in professional development planning, because if you identify skill gaps, then you can say, okay, hey, take this, you know, 20-minute video, you're going to fill that hole in. Take this course here to fill those holes in. Plus, teams aren't doing redundant training, which is really demoralizing. I already know this stuff. Why am I getting trained in this? No, get trained in the stuff you need to know. Teams appreciate it. You'll appreciate it because it's making your business more successful and more secure. IT Pro TV is now ACI Learning. That's the bottom line. And they are better than ever. Keep your business from risking redundancy by consistently offering the most up-to-date certs and courses available. You'll have a personal account manager at ACI Learning who makes sure you're not wasting your time or money. They'll work with you so that your team focuses on the skills that matter to your organization and not on the skills that don't. Again, saves time and money. They are ISO certified. I know for a lot of you, that's important. You know you're getting the best training possible. Keep your IT team up with the speed of technology. Visit go.acilearning.com/twit. You Twit listeners will get a free trial, and the discounts are huge, as much as 65% with an IT Pro Enterprise solution plan. Here's what you do. You go, you fill out the form. The discounts are based on your team size. They'll let you know exactly how much you're going to save. It really is a great solution for anybody who wants to either get into IT or keep your team skills up to date. go.acilearning.com/twit. We've known these guys since they started, and I'm a big believer in what they're doing. It really is high quality. go.acilearning.com/twit. And obviously, they're believers in us, which we like. We appreciate it. Thank you, ACI Learning. go.acilearning.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of Mac Break Weekly. Now, times for our picks of the week. I'm going to start off because I've been meaning to show you this. You know Manu Cornet, or Cornet. He is the former Google engineer, the former Twitter engineer, who also is a very well-known cartoonist. And he has compiled all of the cartoons and writing he did during the fall of Twitter.
I remember those.
Yes, they're so good. Remember the jet airplane going down, burnt on fire, and so forth. It's called TwitToons. It's at twittoons.com. Not to be confused with twit.tv, TwitToons.com. Man, who's a good friend. He actually was on Twig as Twitter started to crash and burn. And I just think he's done such a great job with this. I read it on the plane, and it just came out. There it is. You can get it on Amazon, it looks like, too. TwitToons, one employee's cartoon chronicle of Twitter's accelerated descent. And it is accelerated. he was the first, I think, his claim to fame, he was the first employee fired by Elon, right? He says when he was on Twig, he said, we were all so excited. We thought Elon's going to, you know, take this place and wake it up and really take it somewhere. But
he did take it somewhere.
Yeah, it wasn't exactly the direction. And by the way, Manu is a great cartoonist, as you can see. He really is able to capture what's going on. It's good. Twitoons! Available at fighter bookstores everywhere. Alex Lindsay, your pick of the week, sir.
So it kind of snuck out last week from Apple, and I just want to make sure people knew it was there. Reality Composer. So that's been available, you know, and it started off in developer only, but now it's publicly available, and Apple released Reality Composer. And here's the thing that they added to it is the ability to do 3D capture. So object capture is now built into Reality Composer. So you can say, I'd like to capture an object with my phone, and the way Apple does things, it's really good. so it has a lot of like, just, It you point it at something and it just knows, you know, Apple did all the work so that you don't have to. And it just knows, oh, this is the object you're trying to capture. So it builds a little box around it. And then it gives you a little guide to follow along. And it does like, okay, just go around it. Now go around it really low. And it might tell you, like, it'll make a decision about, should I flip it or should I not flip it? Because it'll just ask you to flip it over, like flip this object over so that you can capture it. And then it'll ask you to go, you know, do a high pass and a low pass. But it's guiding you. And the more you do it, what's interesting, I've only had it for a couple of days. And the more you do it, you get kind of used to all these little interfaces that it's showing you, like, turn this way, you know, keep moving around. And you see this little dial that's going around it. You can see there. And it is telling you where you're at and what you're trying to cover. So you can figure out where you need to be to do this. You don't have to know anything. There's a little bit, I will say, there's a little bit of practice to get used to what the interface is telling you. But like half an hour of practice. And now you can capture objects and it'll immediately textures everything, capture that object and let you, you know, bring it in. Like now you could literally capture that and put it in your Keynote document. So you can go, I want to, you know, like, so, you know, this is where we start to see this integration starting to come together, where you can go around you can find an object that you want to use for a presentation, for a school, you know, education, those types of things. You can capture that object in the real world and immediately just drop it into Keynote and rotate it into the position that you want to put it in Keynote or even animate it. And all of that stuff that is really straightforward. It's pretty powerful. You know, as someone who's been doing, I started doing photogrammetry almost 30 years ago, like, you know, 29 years ago, I started doing photogrammetry where we had to put a box in. Into a scene, we'd be in like a little city scene, and we put a box in, and then figure out by hand our vanishing points so that the box matched the vanishing points, and then start opening up boxes one at a time to fill this all in, and then it was revolutionary to not have to do to only have to identify points 25 years ago, where we just identify points in the scene, and it would start to, and then it would still guide us on where to put the boxes. and then there was a huge jump forward about 10 years ago, where we could take a bunch of photos and it would just turn them into, you know, a model. And so I just want to, as an old fogey here, I just want to say, you have no idea what you're looking at. This is insane that I can download a free application on my iPhone and wander around an object following the interface and end up with a high resolution model. It's magical. Like, it is really a magical thing that Apple's doing here as far as being able to capture objects. And now that it's integrated with what just happened with Keynote, you know, it's pretty interesting, you know, and not just Keynote, but you have a USDZ model you could bring into Motion. You could, you know, do other things with it. You can animate it. And so anyway, I think it's pretty slick. So I would check it out.
Nice. Is it free on the iPhone?
It is. It's free.
Wow.
It's made by Apple. So it's free.
And, oh, yeah. Oh,
Reality,
cool.
Reality Composer is, you know, it's funny. I hadn't opened Reality Composer for a long time, and I realized that I have all these other models that I've been putting into it for the last 4 years. And so Reality Composer has been out for a while, but it was a developer tool. Now it's a public tool. And again, the new thing that happened over the last update. So it's been out for a while, but the new thing that is the last update is the fact that you can, now they put the capture tools. They had built a library for other people to do the captures. So other companies were, you know, doing it with variety of level of success and user interface. And so Apple's done their own. It's for object capture. It's pretty slick.
I noticed it has, when I went to my Apple store, it has a little cloud that says I downloaded it before. So I must have downloaded it. And
probably I talked about it earlier, like when it came out in three more public, probably me recommending it 2 years ago or something like that. And, you know, I still use Polycam for capturing locations. So when I'm out of space, I don't think this object, it's an object capture. So I will say that, and I pay money for that. And I pay like $100 a year for a Polycam.
Wow.
Polycam is, I don't find that the object capture is that great, but when I'm trying to capture, like I've walked around, we're looking for new space right now. So I've been walking around digitizing spaces. So I just wander around.
That's a good idea.
I walk around with my iPhone. That way I can show it because the owner of it, I know, Mark East. he's in San Diego or New York or whatever. So I went into a new space and I just wandered around and captured
what
a whole
thing. What a good idea.
And then sent him a USDZ model. And then he's like, what about this? And what about this? And I'm like, oh, you have to, you know, and so it's, so Polycam is still good for that. This is specifically, I want to put objects into something.
Nice. Reality Composer free in the Play Store. I remember when you came to, probably call for help with the screensavers back in the day on Tech TV, and you used a magic marker to put dots on my head.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That was call for help, and that was it. And that was before you went to Canada. That was
the old days. Yeah. Early 2000s to do the same thing that you can now just take a phone and
exactly. I mean, that was, we put a bunch of markers on your face and then we took a bunch of the photos and then
took me a long time to get those dots off. No, I don't think it was that hard, but I think you were using a Sharpie, right? It was just a regular.
I don't think I used a Sharpie, but maybe I did. I think I might have used something.
Toxic, non-toxic.
More washable.
It's all just legal mumbo jumbo.
It's TV. It's good TV. You know, the host walks around with dots on his face for a week.
I think it was like black makeup, like eyelash.
Back then we were using
like eyelash.
Eyeliner,
I think was our popular thing at the moment.
Mr. Andy Inoko, pick of the week.
Okay, there's good and then there's great. Good is Patrick Stewart writing a memoir, okay? Great is him recording the audiobook of that memoir. And so, that's why I was he's been making the press tours for his new memoir called Making It So. And I was interested in the book. I thought, okay, maybe I'll buy that sometime. Maybe I'll wait for it to acquire secondhand. But then I realized that, ooh, I bet he recorded the audiobook of that. And then I went to Audible and said, oh, he did. Okay, that's $25 that I'm very, very happy to part with. I've only gotten into like the first like half hour to an hour. It's an 18-hour book, but him reading anything is amazing. Him telling his own story from the very beginning and him having one of those great, I'm sorry, I don't want to call it great, but in terms of storytelling, growing up in a tiny house without a bathroom with a family and father and mother who are like washerwoman and ex-military who was on hard times, and him not thinking that people like him could be actors, that's such a fun, such a wonderful story. So I haven't gotten too big into it, but him reading this story is just incredible. That's the highest recommendation I can give. Patrick Stewart telling his own story and acting it out. He can't help but act it out. I read some of the reviews. It takes the good news is that it does take 300 pages before he gets to before he gets to The Next Generation. The New York Times complained a little bit that the reviewer, I think, made a correct observation in that they really, 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 really wish that he talked a lot about his friendship with Ian McKellen, and they didn't get enough of that, like a lot of Hollywood stuff. But still, I cannot imagine this ever going south. 18 hours for $25, I'll take it. Also, if you go to I first looked for it on Amazon, and they have like if you're not a member of Audible, they have a deal where instead of paying $25, you could commit to 3 months of Audible for like $6 a month and keep the 3 books that you buy and still wind up $7 ahead of the deal. I'm the sort of person who would forget to cancel after the first 3 months, so I just bought the book outright, but putting that information out there. There's a sample of him reading on the audible.com website that will probably convince you if you haven't been convinced already.
Nice. Sir Patrick Stewart, Making It So.
Tea, Earl Grey, hot.
Now, the odds were in the chat room that Mr. Alex Lindsay would scoop you, Jason Snell, on your pick of the week. I don't know if Alex saw what you were going to pick or not, but he did not. So you get to talk
about it. Who is going to choose the $280 teleprompter?
And it's
going to
be guess you're right. Not
Elgato
Alex.
Nice stuff for people in this sort of mid-range of you're doing video on the internet, but you're not a, you know, broadcast professional, but you're doing video on the internet and you want nice stuff. And so, like, I've got their green screen and I use a Stream Deck, and like, they have made some nice stuff. Their new product is called Prompter. It is a one-piece teleprompter thing that it's got a screen and it's got the two-way glass and it's got mounts. And so you can set it up. So if you're somebody who does a lot of teleprompting, you could do this. And I haven't tried it out yet, but I will tell you, Tom Warren at The Verge has tried it out. He wrote about it today. And he said, this is perfect for me because he's a guy on the internet who has to do videos and he can do them with his script in the prompter. Can you, for vastly less than $280, make a somewhat janky but perfectly usable setup using like an iPad and a mirror? And you can, yes, I bought one of those in pieces and it was very hard to put together. And it was, you know, it worked. It was shaky, but it worked. But if you are somebody who thinks, I just want it to work and I don't mind spending $280 on it, the fact that Tom Warren basically said, yeah, I will use this. This is what I want. I take that. Tom's great. He does good work. And I'm intrigued by this as well. I don't do that much stuff with a teleprompter, but, you know, it actually, his write-up made me kind of want to start doing videos.
Don't stop.
With a teleprompter.
No teleprompters.
Well, if, you know, I do. So my friend David Sparks does a bunch of, basically they're what used to be books, but now you do them as a series of videos and it's a course about something. And the challenge with that is that you need periods where you need to communicate and you need to hit all the points. And those are the parts. That's why I bought the other teleprompters. I was thinking about doing one of those. And but you know it if you need it. And Elgato, I will also just say again, is their stuff the cheapest? It is not. Is it nice? Yes, it is. And so if
this
you're,
is cheap for a teleprompter,
it's not
really,
bad, right?
Really?
Like,
cheap
again, you can spend $100 and get a janky mirror with
no,
a mount.
No, this is for a real teleprompter. This is incredibly cheap.
If you don't want to fiddle with it, $280. Yeah.
And the review says it can just act as an external monitor. So if all you want to do is to be able to like make eye contact with the person you're talking to on Zoom while you're looking directly at them, that intrigues me.
Yeah. Or even do a screencast where instead of recording and having the video be kind of like in a webcam somewhere, you could do a screencast while looking right at the screen, and yet you could use that in your video and it'll look natural like you're looking at the screen. Lots of interesting potential here. Yeah. So I thought it was worth a pick.
What we found with screencast specifically is resolution. Like that one's going to be pretty small. Like for screencasts, we
use
very pretty big ones because, I mean, sometimes the largest one we built for that was like 55 inches because we just really felt like we had to see a lot there for screencast specifically. But for eye contact, I mean, we've been doing the quote unquote Interatron, which is Errol Morris's kind
Errol Morris, right?
For 15 years, you know, we had one client that was obsessed with it, and we just kept on going down that path, and so I think
so. To explain what that is, Errol Morris, a famous documentarian, would put himself on a screen with the camera going through it, and you would talk to his video picture.
Yeah, you were looking right at the camera lens. Yeah.
And it was his opinion that he got better interviews.
And he's right.
By not being in the room and not being off camera.
And not having to be sort of subject communicating with a camera lens, but to a human face that's having a conversation with. Yeah,
right. It was a much more natural thing for the initiated interviewee, but it gave him great results. And if you ever watched Thin Blue Line or any of his documentaries, he certainly did.
And the funny thing is that I have probably shot more in Interatron than Errol Morris at this point.
Yeah, I'm sure you have. You know,
thousands and thousands and thousands of hours based on what he's done. And of live video. And one of the things we noticed was that it also, your eyes and your face do different things when you see the person in front of you. So one is your eyes converge on the face and your eyes will do something just slightly different. I mean, it's like less than a millimeter, but it feels different than when you're just looking at a camera. And in addition to that, we do this thing where we mirror the other person. And so your face does different things when it's talking to someone as opposed to just a camera. And so it's a really powerful way to do it. To underline what Jason said, we talked about this for like, I don't know, 10 or 20 minutes today in office hours because it just came out. And so someone brought it up. And a couple things about it that are really powerful is that first we thought it was only going to work with their webcam, but it's got all these features that let you fit a still camera, all kinds of other cameras. It's got these little fittings on the back so that that'll work. It is really convenient and much smaller. So in addition to it to being less expensive, I have an iCan. I have 10 iCan teleprompters for our kits that we send out. This one would be way simpler. It's a quarter of the price that we're paying or a little less than a quarter of the price a little more than a quarter of the price. And it is much simpler to set up. If I was going to send this out as a kit, I would send this one out as opposed to what I've been sending out because it's becoming much easier for someone on the other end to put together. I'm going to buy one to test it. I've given up on asking Elgato. They always tell me I'm not important enough for them to send me something. But I'll probably buy one, and then, you know, if I like it, I'll keep it and I'll send it back. But the but I think that it's a it looks like it's a great solution. Like, and I'm only concerned that the glass is a little too small. Like, I'm hoping that they do a plus version that's like 50 or 100% bigger than that. But I think that as a first try, and Elgato does a lot of great stuff. I mean, I have four Stream Decks on my desk, you know, and they're really good at that.
This works with Stream Deck. You can use Stream Deck to advance or stop the prompter too.
Yeah. Which is fine. You know, I think that their prompter software
is better.
The prompter software, I was like, it's the kind of prompter software you write when you do it the first time. So that'll get better. But I will say that the way that they figure what Elgato is really good at is figuring out how to make it compact and easy to use and just have it just kind of work. And so I think it looks really good. And I'm really excited to test one because I think we'll end up using them in our kits. Hmm.
So it was an Alex pick after all, Jason.
I didn't have one yet.
Jason beat me to it, but I was like,
he scooped you.
I don't ever recommend hardware that I haven't tested because I don't trust anybody.
Right, that's why I think we use prompters.
Yeah, I hate prompters, and we bought them because some of our hosts needed them and wanted them.
I can't use them. Like I can use them.
I'm very good with a prompter. I learned how to do it in television, but I just don't like them. I don't know why.
When someone sends me something that I have to do, I'm really good at it. Like, I can just read it. When I wrote the content, I can't stop editing. So I go into this cycle of like that one little word isn't right, or I need one more space. Or I should have put a dot there. And so if I write it, and like, I'm always amazed by YouTubers that can just knock them out like that, because if I write it while I'm writing it, I'm re-editing it going, this isn't quite right. Like, I need to do this again. And so if someone else sends me a script, I can read a teleprompter. The only problem, even with someone who's really good, there's this glassy eye thing that you get.
That's what I don't like.
I don't like. And you either see scanning. Now, with the one this small, you won't see scanning. People, like, if the teleprompter's too big and too close to you, you'll see their eyes doing this little thing where they're reading it.
They're reading.
But if they don't do that, and they get good at reading without scanning, you see this glassy, it's just a telltale glassy eye look. I'm rooting for everybody. This is the red pill.
I can always tell when somebody's reading a prompter. Always.
If you know, too slow. No, fast. No.
Well, it's just this, there's a dead eye look that anyone reading a teleprompter always has. And it's just that you're reading
something. That's what
bothers me. Yeah. And it bothers me too. And I feel like it's not, I think that when you look at the creators that are doing really, really well, they're really, really good at eye contact, and there's something that the teleprompter takes away from that that you can't get back. And so I'm not a big fan of reading it. I love them for Interatron, though. Like, they, you know, we've been using
that's them actually a really good use. We use them. I think probably Jason and Micah use it on Tech News Weekly. There are a few shows we use them on. You won't catch me using them.
I probably use them in I've done, you know, a couple thousand events and in the last decade, and I think we probably used a teleprompter 50 times out of thousands of times using them as Interatron. Like, that's what for us, the teleprompters are all about seeing another person on the other side.
Sometimes, though, you got to say a lot of copy and you don't have time to memorize it and you don't want to be reading it. There's all sorts of reasons you need a teleprompter. I would defocus so I didn't get that glassy-eyed look. I kind of defocus and try to make contact. But invariably, I would, just like you, Alex, I would change the copy as we're reading it.
Sure.
And it would invariably happen that suddenly the prompter copy would be going up and down like this.
And I don't know where you are.
Prompter operator trying to figure out, where is he? What is he doing? What is he doing?
For some of my self-scripted stuff, I've just used it as a with the bullet points.
Yeah, basically. Bullet points are
like,
fine.
I know what I need to hit, and then I'm going to use them in my own words, and it sounds more natural, but I don't want to forget one of the bullet points.
That's what it's good
to do
for.
It all again.
Yeah. That's essentially what I did on Tech TV. So I would say, please make that bullet points, because I don't want to be reading.
Right. I know how to make sentences. I can make words into sentences. Yeah. I can do that.
And it's, you know, there's a certain way people speak when they are extemporizing versus when they're reading, and we know the difference.
I think they're getting better at Apple, but we used to call it the we used to call it the teleprompter pentameter,
yeah.
Which is that there's this thing where they move the screen and you can hear it. You can hear it when they're talking. They'll stop at the end of the paragraph as waiting for the next one to come. And for a while, Apple really had it. Like it was like, because with executives, they don't have time to, they practice it a couple times, then they do it.
But it's not their job. It's not as a presenter. Right. They're not presenters.
But Apple, I think, got the message. And I think that like Tim Cook is getting better every show. Like you can tell he's working.
They're all a lot better. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's what happened was, is that they realized that this takes work. Like it takes work to do that. I mean, that's the company that probably does it the best is still Salesforce. I don't use any of their products. but we used to do a lot of streams for them and we watched them. They got really serious. And when they got really serious, suddenly all of their stuff, but they memorize everything. Like they don't
that's
use any teleprompters. They memorize literally every word. Yeah,
that's
amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. You can always tell in Saturday Night Live when they're reading cue cards.
Oh, yeah. Always looking off to the left. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, it has been a pleasure to join you from Mom's house. Jason, from Mom's house to Mom's house. I love that. That's how dedicated we are, ladies and gentlemen, to bringing you the latest Apple content.
And to moms.
And to our moms.
A tech pundit's best friend is his mother.
I visited Mom this morning before the show, and she's really happy. She's doing great.
Yay.
I can never remember the name of that thing you sent me, but I love it.
Mine's just like, how long is this show? I'm like, very long. It's very long.
I think she's watching. Because when I left, I'm going to put it on the live stream. And I said, you'll see your house, Mom. You see? There's your house. I'm in your house. Thank you, Mom.
you're reminding me of when I was taking care of my mom. And like she would, I would set her up, make sure she has her snacks, make sure she has her movie going on. And then she'd say, now don't worry about me. Go off and talk to your internet friends. And I'm like, oh. And she knew very well this was a podcast, but probably because she could hear me from the other room, like having a good time. Oh, talk to your internet friends.
There are people in the house right now. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, saying, is he done? Is he done? Are you through? Can I walk through now? I said, it's the house. You can walk through.
Can I start watching Netflix again, or are you still bandwidth capped?
No Netflix. Ladies and gentlemen, Jason Snell is at sixcolors.com. His shows are at sixcolors.com/Jason. He does many, many other podcasts and never reads a prompter on one of them.
I'm looking right in your eyes. That's what
right
I'm doing.
Right in my eyes. It's a little creepy, so stop it. Knock it off.
Okay.
Sixcolors.com is a great place. You also see him in Macworld and other places. Thank you, Jason. Yeah.
Thank you, Leo, as always.
Is Mom in Arizona?
Arizona. Yeah, it's so hot here. Oh, God. Help.
Well, you know, it's funny because winter is coming in New England. And it's getting chilly here, right?
It's like 100.
I just turned the heater on yesterday.
We're in Arizona.
South of Phoenix. Very hot and dry.
Very hot. Very hot. Yeah. And you're there in winter. Thank you, Andy Inoko. GBH in Boston. I don't know if I'm going to be able to make it to the Boston Public Library, but
It's this Friday at 12:30 again at the WGBH studios, video studios, and at the Boston Public Library. So if you want to go watch the show live, the Boston Public Radio show starts at 11, doesn't end until 2 on Fridays. There's often a musical guest. At minimum, you'll be able to see me again. the double hell of like being on camera, because this goes on YouTube as well, and having notes that I really have to go on and trying to make it sound effortless that I'm just coming up with this information, as opposed to, no, I'm reading these names and these numbers off of an iPad. But
yeah,
so watch me be uncomfortable. And if you can't watch me live, go to WGBHnews.org and you can stream it live or later. Or again, go to WGBH News channel on YouTube to stream it live or later.
You got to do what I do, Andy. Really lower expectations. I just get stuff wrong all the time. And then nobody, it's like, he goes again.
Or maybe I should do the thing that Marlon Brando used to do in his old age. He would just basically like tape his lines to the forehead. No, he would tape a script page to the forehead of the person doing the scene with.
Yeah. It's famous in The Godfather. They would go around in scenes. They all had little pieces of script taped to them in various places so Marlon could read them. Oy, oy, oy. Mr. Alex Lindsay, officehours.global is a great place if you are interested in production. Well, just about anything. These are the polymaths of the internet gathering together each morning, every day. Officehours.global has an invitation, so you can join the Zoom conference or you can watch them on YouTube. What do you got coming up?
we just had yesterday, we had Ian McKaig on. So we had Ian McKaig on,
Ian's
on
great.
Gray Matter over a week ago. And what was great is that I was able to bring him back into office hours. So we got to listen to Gray Matter and then ask another set of questions.
Follow up.
So we had a great conversation specifically about storytelling. And it was an amazing.
He worked at Lucas, right?
He's worked at Lucasfilm. He's worked on many, many movies. an incredible, just so much fun to listen to, and also an incredible storyteller. And so, it was really, really a great, great hour. And that was just yesterday morning. So you can see it at Office Hours.
Office Hours on YouTube.
Yeah.
And of course, if you want to hire Alex, and learn how to do shows with or without prompter, 090.
Let you use a prompter if you want.
You
to
can use if you have to. You can get it. 090.media is his day job.
Office Hours is a place of safety and love where we don't judge unless your life is just a little bit off, in which case they will judge the hell out of you. But with love,
we don't judge you if you're perfect.
Alex has a telestrator and he's not afraid to use it. Yeah, exactly. Let's put it that way. Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Andy. Thank you, Jason. Thanks to all of you for joining us. We do Mac Break Weekly. Rain or shine, no matter where our hosts are, every Tuesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern. That's 1800 UTC, although got two more weeks at that time, and then we're going to move. We have already, we are still in summertime, but I know a lot of you have already moved to standard time. We will do that first week and in November, and that's when it'll change. But I'll let you know at the time. So for right now, still 1800 UTC. The only reason it matters at all is if you want to watch us live, you can do that or listen live at live.twit.tv. There's streams there. If you are watching live, chat with us live at irc.twit.tv. Of course, Club Twit members get access beyond the velvet rope. If you're not yet a Club Twit member, $7 a month gets you ad-free versions of all the shows, access to the Discord, which is more than just chat for the shows. It's where geeks gather to talk about all kinds of things. And it is a really great safe space. My favorite social media. Plus the Twit Plus feed with shows we don't put out anywhere else, including Hands on Macintosh, Hands on Windows, the Untitled Linux show, and Scott Wilkinson's Home Theater Geeks. That's one of the newer shows in there. Giz Fizz with Vic DiBartolo. A lot of those shows end up getting into the mainstream, as This Week in Space did. But for now, they're inside the club because the club members pay for it with their $7 a month. Live.twit.tv. Join us. We're going to have a wonderful party. Live.twit.tv. Twit.tv/club, I should say, for joining the club. $7 a month, and we thank you in advance. It is more and more important. I don't know if you guys saw, the WNYC is pretty much shutting down. It was one of the premier prestigious podcast studios, and they're basically saying to all their podcasts, if you can't make it on radio, we don't have room for you. So it's a tough time. I don't know why podcast advertising is disappearing, but it's why the club is so very important to us long term. Thanks in advance, and we'll see y'all next time. But now I have to say, it is my sad and yes, somewhat humbling duty to say, get back to work. Break time is over. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Hey, I'm Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine, and each week I join with my co-host to bring you This Week in Space, the latest and greatest news from the final frontier. We talk to NASA chiefs, space scientists, engineers, educators, and artists, and sometimes we just shoot the breeze over what's hot and what's not in space books and TV. And we do it all for you, our fellow true believers. So whether you're an armchair adventurer or waiting for your turn to grab a slot in Elon's Mars rocket, join us on This Week in Space and be part of the greatest adventure of all time.